All right, we're going to go ahead and call this session to order. This is our regular scheduled board discussion session. And normally we take turns and go around, but I'm going to, because we have to get some housekeeping done, I'm going to railroad this thing for just a minute if you don't mind. We've got to get some things done on the superintendent search today. We can't be scrolling out of time, and I promise we'll have enough time. This won't take very long. I think you all had this list from last time. It was kind of Judy's notes as to what we did and what was going to be happening. One piece of housekeeping I want to get done first is Judy tells us there's been some inquiries, I guess to her office, or I don't know who, from some staff members, principals, people, the superintendent leadership council, people like that, our staff members who have wanted, how can they have input? How can they give their input? To have a special meeting, I don't know if it'd be kind of unwieldy, if not damn near impossible, to do that with staff members who all work during the day and at various places. But I just want to get your thoughts on it. At very least, I was going to have Judy type up a memo, if that would be appropriate, to all the district employees, however we disseminate that through email, whatever, telling them that, that please feel free to call us, then call Judy, get our numbers, things like that. At the very least, I think we ought to do that. Certainly, I know there's people who have contacted probably all of us. I know there's people who have contacted me. But I just need some kind of input on that, because that's a group we can't, I don't want to ignore, but I also, and we can't just have another, my first thought was at the next meeting, devote an hour just to them, but we can't limit it just to employees. So I just need some thoughts on something like that.
The employees didn't show up at the last one today. Did we have any employees come to the system input?
Yeah, Mrs. Honey, she gave the giraffe.
Yes.
Okay. So I think a letter, I would agree, a letter with in writing, but that I think that as you mentioned, we would have another time as an agenda item on our business meeting to allow additional input or no?
No, I don't recall that.
Is that what we want to do after we invite? So they're only going to invite to email us individually?
Or call on Express, carrier pigeon?
Matt, if I recall correctly, and I had located this for the last meeting and I put it back, but I recall that when we did the previous search, we did ask through the superintendent to get feedback, and there was a document that had a list of suggestions from the superintendent's leadership council. There was something from principals, and I think the challenge with that, as we saw when we had the public input, is that you don't want to put anyone in a position where any suggestion they make could be misconstrued as a criticism of the existing superintendent. And so that creates a very delicate situation. And I think that's one of the reasons why people would not want to publicly come before the board and make those kinds of comments. I think that an email, a mass email to each of those groups would be appropriate, but there has to be more than an email outreach to let people know that we want their input. And I don't know Dr. Adams, what you think. Previously it was Dr. LaCava who provided that document to the board, and I don't know if you find that would be useful, or if you feel that would not really be useful to have a powwow with the leadership council when you meet with your principals, or at those meetings encourage them, to contact the board and share their thoughts with us.
I think for the leaders, I think it would be useful to have a neutral party come in and try and get some input. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to try and get input from the leadership group, but I think that there are groups that did the union speak on behalf of teachers? Did CWA speak on behalf of their employees? I mean, I think you can look at groups as well. But I think that through the principals, I think we could facilitate some, even if it's not discussion, some written information. Sending it out to the employees is not a bad idea. I think at least employees feel like you're asking for their input. It may be you want to channel it to certain people and not just have it come to everybody. I don't know. channel it to.
Within a day or two, I could have a website up that has a survey built in where they could provide anonymous feedback, and it would be outside of the school district's server, so there's no concerns with that. And it would, the board members could look at it and see for themselves. You know, just some comment. I guess that would be a sunshine thing, but it's just a fact-finding tool.
The good thing about one-on-one conversations, obviously, is it's out of the sunshine. You can have a one-on-one conversation with anybody I want to you for. But I don't remember
doing it last time. I don't remember anybody coming to a group
for the board meeting. But you know, maybe a facilitated, at a principal's meeting, just having a neutral facilitator come in and get their input, and the same thing with the superintendent's leadership council, a neutral facilitator. That would at least give us two sources of information. IRCEA was present at the public comment and gave their suggestions, and Mr. Flink specifically made the point to say, this is not my, I'm not speaking on my behalf, I'm speaking on behalf of the teachers. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the CWA would be willing to do the same thing, and then we just have to let the rest of our staff and maybe via email know.
Just let anybody contact us by email. They all have our phone numbers and email addresses, and send it to whoever you want to send it to. We were going to have Judy send out a memo to the principals, and if principals
want to get together collectively and send us a letter, whatever.
I am making calls to the applicants, and I'm telling you, they have looked up each one of our bios. People, and I'm getting emails on people, and have told me, you know, stuff about myself. I can tell you that I am getting emails, and I hope you all are getting emails from teachers and the public, so they know how to find us. But any, I think, to finish that, an invitation from Ms. Stang would be fine.
Judy, you gonna make that magic happen?
Yes, sir.
Atta girl.
I still get a lot of anonymous calls too.
Okay, on March 3rd, Dr. Blanton will be here. Okay, and at that time, we'll come together as a board. He's going to come. He's going to help facilitate. That's the 20th is the day that applications are due in, or you know, resumes applications are due in. We have a cutoff then that gives us till the 3rd to do any homework and get ready for when he comes. It's important to remember when he comes. He is facilitating the search. He's not leading the search. It's not his search. It's our search. We will be making the call. On who the finalists are. At that point, the goal is to get down a group of finalists. I'm going to show you. This is what we had last time when we did this back in 2011. And and it says on there, you can see, Dr. Blanton will... Again, it will be driven by us, but you know he's done this so many times and he knows all the players in Florida. Really good person to help us along and can really frankly answer a lot of questions out to the Florida folks. That number three on the list is the big one at that time. Now we talked about set interview dates, site visit selections. We don't actually set the dates that day. Judy has to contact the individuals and we go. Now if the superintendent search is kind of slow till this date. Once this date here, it's 3 weeks of a sprint, okay, and then it's over with. We also have to have, we either discuss that day or at a separate time, we all have to get together on contract parameters. That's what we can all live with in terms of parameters on contract, both monetary issues and other issues, okay? We did not last time remember I said we had a list of questions. And I have, thanks to Ms. Judy, again, just for an example, the list we used last year, see the type of stuff we were doing. It seemed we did not have to follow that protocol. It seemed to work fairly well. All right? What we had, you can see each board number. It seemed to work pretty well. Not everything we have to do it that way, but it, it's it gave us a baseline of the same questions being asked of every candidate, and then we had sufficient time where if there was something that came up during the interest questions, something on the resume you wanted to know more information, anything like that, we had an open-ended kind of discussion. So, again, be thinking of what areas you want to ask questions about. If this format is acceptable to you, or not acceptable, but if you want to continue following that, because we need to come up to that, again, we will readdress this process when Dr. Bland's here on the 3rd. Okay? Not necessarily have to have every question went out. We'll readdress the process. The other thing is...
I want to respect you.
Okay. What, you don't remember those questions?
Oh, yes.
The other thing we needed to go over today, at least get the ball rolling on the logistics of once we set up interviews. Okay? We have an interview set up. The way we did it last year is we invited some community members who were here, had the person come in, spend a specified amount of time, I don't even remember, half hour, 45 minutes, something like that.
Matt, here's the document.
They would
want to have copies.
All right. They would recess.
It was an hour.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't an hour.
Okay.
It went fast, whatever time was.
Sure did.
Pepper the question. They would leave. We convened at the dais. We brought them in. I can tell you, I think everybody's hired somebody, and if I hire a staff account, it's a completely different animal. This is because the sunshine is a very clunky kind of formal process, but it is what it is. We do need to have a staff member available.
Okay.
When you came on board, Dr. Adams, we still had Ms. Vasquez, who was she coordinated everything with the candidates, meaning getting them here. I even think she, facilitated in and out, make sure they were taken care of. I even think she might have done something with the spouses or anybody who brought their spouse to show them around, things like that. We're going to have at least one staff member dedicated to just babysitting the candidates when they get here.
Okay.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to know until the 3rd, but if we have any out-of-town candidates, mm-hmm. we've got to get them down here. We're going to have to get them down, put them up for a night or so, and mm-hmm. depending on where they have come from, we're going to have to put them up. Again, those are all stuff we're going to go through on the 3rd. All right? I know that's a lot of information in a very short time. Judy, am I forgetting anything?
Televising the interviews, is it necessary?
Yeah, we had a conversation with Ms. DeGresta. Last time we televised them, but did not stream them. And they weren't available until after all the interviews were done. And talking with Ms. DeGresta, we talked for you, but she said, it's not a requirement. In fact, we don't even have to audio tape them. We can have them done just, shorthand notes. So maybe take minutes. Do we want to have them video or audio tape?
Can I have that back? I think there was language there describing what we did.
The benefit of having them videotape, though, is if you want to go back and review what each candidate said.
And I think
we'll be listing them in some order, and there may be something said in those interviews that
And I think that's one of the reasons we ended up doing it. So
whether you stream it or not, I don't know about all that stuff.
We can do afterwards, but the problem is we didn't want to make them available to the public. It's a public meeting. If somebody, if a candidate's going last and wants to come in here and sit in them, we can't stop them from doing that. But we didn't want to put it out there on the web for the candidate who's going last to watch all the other ones first.
Yeah. So they'd be available to us. Then?
Okay. Yeah, I believe so.
I think videoing is a good.
Okay. Everybody all right with that? There was one other. In terms of voting process, again, there is nothing in statute. We can do it however we want. Dr. Bland helped us. It was last year the narrowing of the 5 was very easy. It's just, almost all board members and Dr. Bland, we had just basically the same 5 almost. That part was easy, and I'm not worried about that. But once we get down to the 5, you have all the interviews, and it's. We did it that same night, didn't we? Or did we come together later? Do you remember? It was the same night as the last interview.
Yes.
Yeah. So the night of the last interview, so what you're talking about, would, if we follow protocol from last time, whoever it was, Dr. Adams, last interview is is over with, that time's up, okay, she leaves the room, remember the public meeting, they still here, we put chairs, put tables together right here, and just started discussing amongst five people. What we ended up doing is a straw poll. I think ranked 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, it was real highly technical. I sat there and, you know, while everybody's watching me, I'm sitting here adding, praying that I don't make a math error.
Oh, really? Five.
That was so good for a business, you know?
That would be so
fun. I mean, it was, and I'm sitting here furiously just trying to add things.
We'll bring a calculator.
We ended up, we narrowed it down to Judy said, Judy, we ended up with three straw polls, correct?
That's what we have recorded there.
So we narrowed it down from five, narrowed it down, and it came up, and the very last poll was between Dr. Adams and Dr. Jim, and Mr. Jim, excuse me. And that's how it worked. Open to suggestions. Do you want to make the final decision that night of the last interview? Or do you want some time to go back and get together again a couple nights later? It's got to be an open meeting, so it's got to be noticed.
Probably need to do it a couple nights later, so we can go back and review those tapes.
That's where I was going with it. Yeah, that's where I was going with that. If you don't want to review all the tapes, then we might need a few days.
We're only talking about top five, or five.
We could end, you know, we'll learn that on March 3rd. We could end up with three. We could end up with seven. We're not. It depends on how many you guys, you know, there's candidates. Number one is, do we want to be working on a schedule? Again, we're going to set the interview dates, and that's going to be flexible, you know, and that's just going to be just make sure we're all available. My suggestion is to get with Judy and all of us individually. Look at those 2 weeks that are open or whatever it is. Let her know days that you just can't do it. Okay? So she will start the minute we're done with here March 3rd. She's going to start setting up those interviews, getting people here. It sounds like whatever date that last interview is, we will not make the decision that night. Have the fifth interview, either that morning or that day, whatever it turns out to be. Adjourn the meeting for the night. Go home and come back again. It's going to be logistics, what day of the week it is. But come back at a time a few days after that to get together again. How long do we have to notice that meeting? 7 days?
Well, a specially set school board meeting is on 48-hour notice. You have to post and post an agenda within a 48-hour notice, okay. Period. So it's essentially 2 days. But I would imagine that you'll kind of have an idea of your schedules at the time of that last interview, and then you can say when you'd like to reconvene to make your final decision.
Okay. All right. So also, you know, like I alluded to, again, I'll come back around to the actual voting process. You don't have to make a decision right here, right now. We have to have some way to, like I said, once we get down to the five, we're going to have some way of voting it after discussion. So we can discuss that again on March 3rd when Dr. Bland's here. And again, I always ask him, he's done this many times, doesn't he? Any other decisions? Or any...
What's wrong with the way you did it before?
Nothing.
Sounds good to me.
I just don't want to say, we did it this way last time, so that's the way we're going to do it. I just want to make sure everybody's on the same page.
It all works every time.
Yeah.
Finish your thought.
No, I'm finished.
Okay. I just wanted to ask about the questions. Once we speak with Dr. Blanton, we're just going to be moving a mile a minute. Do you think we're going to have enough time, given the schedule, given what our calendars look like, to do you justice to the questions? Because I remember when we did the questions, the last search, we actually, it took time to do. And even though we have the questions from last time, we're at a different place. And so it's not like we're just going to copy those questions and ask those same questions. And when that process was developed, we actually sat as a board and said, okay, what are the most important topics? And we can go back to our visioning and add to it and say, what are the things that we want to ask questions about? And then we develop the questions. And some of those things may be the same, and some of those things may be different. And I'm a little concerned about waiting until March 3rd to do everything. Now, if you think that we're going to have time, you know, well, I'm fine with it. I just wanted to ask.
You know, I don't even think we've established framers. I mean, again, that's why we did it in 2011. You know, we have to have some kind of structure to this thing. Is everybody okay with having to do this question? He's asking the same person and establishing that beforehand.
If a board member has additional questions they want to ask, let's add it. Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, well, how different can it be? Educational. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a good starting point.
Yeah, and we can. It's probably a decent parameter to use in terms of not these questions specifically, but everybody asks a certain question. Then you go into things that are candidate specific or interesting specifically. I think we'll have plenty of time to go through that.
Right.
That's not. I was going to make a joke, but I didn't.
Good job.
Your overarching areas still look appropriate. The overarching areas.
Yeah, they do.
Specific questions may vary, but the overarching
general,
areas are,
you know,
seem pretty relevant.
Jeff's questions look like questions I'd ask, so.
I hope I admit that. I hope that's a rule.
We all serve the entire county.
Okay, so are we, does anybody have any other questions about March 3rd?
Yeah.
All right. To go.
So we're paying Dr. Blanton $10,000 to be a facilitator. Is that
and he was has been in charge of all the PR piece of it, advertising, telling us what to do, when to do, things like that. I mean,
but he's not going to help us decide the top five or six.
Oh yeah, he's going to help.
Going to have his input.
He's going to have his input. He'll tell you. Listen, this is the person I would recommend. But we don't. What I'm saying is what I want to make clear that. His voice does not, his thoughts do not supersede anyone of thought. You know, he's got a perspective that nobody else can possibly have. You know, he's doing what he's done for so long. You can use his opinion and give as much credence as you want. But yeah, he'll you know, have top five if he's got, and if we're discussing with somebody, he, you know, if it's public knowledge he's allowed to speak of, you know, he'll tell you. Something about that person, he hear that person, or something good he knows about this person, that person. Again, the Florida candidates, he's going to know. You know, and as a, you know, just as a you know, point of reference, that when they, in 2000, Dr. Kyle comes, 7? 2006, something like that? Is that where we going?
Several years ago.
The board at that time did use a national search firm and paid well over
$55,000. Mm-hmm.
So that's why, you know, when we had the chance to do it here, and, you know, and it didn't go near as smooth as it went in 2008. You know, I haven't gone and talked to her. Okay. I think we're all on the same page for March 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. And like I said, at that point, it'll just be. It'll be on then. Maybe am I missing anything else?
They want to have a community meeting with further input about
the house. Oh, yeah. No, I'm really hoping to stay there. All right.
What you did agree to is send a memo out to all employees asking for feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't say that you wanted to have another community meeting.
Feedback.
No, I do. I think there's any reason to. I
didn't hear any community meetings. They want to contact us?
Absolutely.
Oh, no, not community meeting for employees. Yeah. All right. Ready? I've lost my agenda for today. Okay. As you know, I think, you know, last time what we tried to do is go around just to make sure everybody has enough time. You know, just, you know, everybody, well, of course, everybody's got anything written down, but if you've got several things, just let's hit one thing, and then we'll come back around to you. Mr. Searcy, you're first on the docket.
Capital dollar sharing with charter schools. What I understand, there's a couple thousand students in the charter schools, and they seem to want to have some capital dollars. And, you know, in my way of thinking, that's a couple thousand students that we're not having to house. And I don't have a problem at all with seeing if we can develop some system to share our capital dollars with charter schools. I know there's one word that keeps it from happening, but this board, as smart as we are, should be capable of changing that one word, may to shall. We can do that. We have the ability to make the decision to share the money based on what statute says, if I'm not mistaken. I don't study the statute real often, but I think we have the ability to do that. We have the money. Those are children that we need to be taken care of. And I know that the charter schools get funding from the state. We use tax money to generate the revenues that we have for capital dollars. And if the capital dollars that the charter schools get are not equal to what we get when we raise our capital money, I would like to think that we could share, maybe if they got $100 and we're taxing for $200, we might be able to share $100 with them so that they would have equal funding to what we have. If you look at the results that the charter schools are having, they're pretty successful, in my way of thinking. They're the top schools in the district. Is that right, Ms. Adams? I saw a newspaper article the other day that showed them being the
school grades.
Top school.
School grades.
Yeah, school grades.
Showed it.
So, I don't know what the rest of you folks think, but we need to do that. They're an important part of the school district, and those children deserve just as much credit as the ones that are in our public school. I mean, I can't make it happen unless there's some more, you know, votes with it, but we have to be smart enough to figure out a way to help them with their capital needs. That's my story.
I agree. Only one point of order is that Mr. Searcy said, comparing them to our public schools, the charters, the full title is Public Charter Schools. So in keeping with that thinking, I feel as though, and I spoke with Fran yesterday about this, about how if we're sharing, let's say our student population, 12.5% or somewhere around thereabouts, is our charter students, then perhaps we should be setting aside at least a commensurate pro rata share of capital funds for those students. And it seemed as though you thought that perhaps something along those lines was happening.
With the millage.
With the millage.
With the
okay.
millage.
With the special millage,
yes,
or
the
standard
millage,
ad valorem?
Okay. With the millage that we get for the vote, the ones that was voted in, the charter schools get that pro rata share of the millage dollars.
Okay.
And have since.
How much does that amount to? Both.
Would you know, Kurt? What's that?
About $3
million. $3 million a year?
Yeah.
That the charter schools get?
From the millage.
The charter schools.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's based on per student?
That's based on their pro rata share of the population that they have.
Okay.
So is it 12%?
Yes.
I'm trying to think. It's about 12%. Right. Yeah.
Any further discussion?
I'll just give you my thoughts. I wasn't here for the last, so I had to do some gap in knowledge for myself on how we distributed money the last time. I do want to say, although the schools are high-performing, the children do leave charter and use our baseball fields, our football fields. So they're not making baseball fields and football fields. We have to supply that. We have to supply all that capital improvement for that child to have a full engage in everything that public school has to offer. Charter schools don't always provide that. So we do still have to keep that up and do all those things. But, yes, they are high-performing, and there's a sense of fairness, and there is a word, shall and may. So I did do some backtracking and ask about what the process was the last time. The process the last time, to my understanding, and were you present?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was that we called the charter schools in, because each school is different, and each charter is different. And that we didn't just prorate and give them money. They had to, because we have our own capital needs, so they had to produce their capital needs for their capital outlay, were you present too?
Mm-hmm.
For 10 years, and come and present that to us. and tell us what their needs are. And then based on that presentation, there was a formula. I've also been in discussion with the attorney, and I have the statute here, right? And it's very legalese, but so I might ask on her to explain it. But they are entitled to 1/15 of a cost of a student station. So there's all financial, where Mr. Morrison would be involved, and there's all, they'd make a presentation, and they would, of their capital outlay, not just a, we want to, you know, that I wouldn't be in favor of that myself, I can tell you right now. I want a clear-cut percentage, here we go. You know, that's carte blanche to here you go, either you use it. I mean, there's also statute on, they have to go into a written document that unused, they return, and it's a long process. So if I was open to that process, I would say yes. And if I was open to that process, it would be after the superintendent search. But I would like to hear from the members, first of all, the attorney, about what that process was, and also from the members who were here before to tell us how that process went and how successful that was. Because the charter schools also get funds that the school district doesn't. So I don't know where the... There is maybe... I would agree there may be an inequity. I really do agree. And but how do you solve that? I'm sure the charter schools would want a percentage. There you go. Here you go. I'm not sure what they want, but I could tell you, at sitting with my school district hat, and I've sat with a school a board member for a charter school, you know, I am, you know, advocating that we certainly make sure our capital outlay funds are safe and able to provide all those capital improvements that not only our children in the school district, but also the charter school students come over to use. So it's probably a very, it probably was a very complicated process. So I would like to hear from those, I mean, why reinvent the wheel? I would like to hear a little bit. It doesn't mean that we have to do it the same way, but I really want to make an educated decision on this, and I don't know what the right way is. So I want to take in all that information. So if you can help me, either one of you, on how that went?
The last time that we went through that, that was a one-shot deal. It wasn't meant to be ongoing. It wasn't meant to be pro rata. It wasn't meant to be anything. It was just trying to get a cash infusion to the charter schools. Because, again, there's always, you want to treat everybody equitably. One thing I will say is I understand and I agree with the premise. You know, but it is a much more complicated accounting issue than you can ever imagine. Charter schools do get some money from the state, and the problem is the legislature's always getting involved, mm-hmm. and the laws are always changing. So if you pass a policy, you know, some kind of procedure, you know, you lock yourself in, and then the legislature goes and changes things on you in 6 months, you get yourself in trouble there. And that's always been the you know, the fear, and you know, we're at 1.5 right now. Is it going to go down to 1.25? Who knows? You know, because again, they start talking about doing things legislatively to help charter schools. That's all. That seems to be always on their mind. And fine, if they want, that's great. You know, can we help out the charter schools? Capital, sure, probably can. But I just, you know, I just caution you that it's much bigger. And I probably want to get some information from Card and his group. As they've got nothing better to do, as to exactly as things stand right now,
right.
What charter dollars are going to our charter, our capital dollars are going to our charter schools, you know? I mean, how much, and what's going there, and then look and get a true, percentage, and you know, and see where we are. That's the only thing I would caution on them.
Yeah, and I'd like to comment because I sat on the board at the time, and. You know, it's undeniable that there is inequity. But the challenge that we face is the fact that the legislature is always involved in this process. And when the charter school law was moved forward, the intent was that charter schools be innovative. So when you walk into a charter school, it should be very different from walking into any of our traditional schools. Furthermore, the FTE follows the students to the school. So they get the educational dollars for the students that they need to provide services. Part of the caveat in this situation with the charter schools, you know, you spoke about safety. Well, we talk about wanting our kids to be safe, but charter schools don't have to comply with SREF. So someone has decided that for traditional public schools, it is important that students be safe and comply with SREF. But for some reason, for charter students, that safety is not paramount, and they are exempt. And so charter schools do have some exemptions. And part of the price paid, if you will, for those exemptions is that it was their responsibility to figure out how to obtain their capital dollars. Now, in their wisdom, the state allots money to charter schools. But the problem is that they don't allot enough money to charter schools. And as charter schools have grown, the money for capital for charter schools has not increased in the way that it should have. Now, that is not the fault of the school districts. But what has happened is because the state is not doing their job, the charter schools look at us and say, well, you better give us the money because those are your students too. And they are. It's not that we don't support charter schools. It's the reality of what the legislature has done, and instead of funding them the way they should, they leave it on our shoulders to look like the bad guys, that we don't want to share our capital dollars. If you look at your CAFR, you would see how much debt this school district carries, and that debt we pay with the taxes that come in every year. And if we start taking those taxes and decide that we're going to be magnanimous, and because the state doesn't do their responsibility, now it's our fault, otherwise we're the bad guys. We really need to be level-headed about this. We need to look at the debt that this school district is carrying. We need to look at the expenses that this school district has. And when this happened and I was on the board, we had money that we could say, let's share this money with the charter schools. And when we had money, we did the right thing because it is an inequity. And I'd be lying if I say that in the time that I've been on the board, there hasn't been tensions with the charter schools. Of course there has been tension. But we have been moving to improve that relationship because they are all our children. They all live in our community. But we also have to be realistic, and we have to understand that our job with those dollars we get is to make sure that our district, our traditional schools, we do what we need to do for our traditional schools. We can't just turn around and assume the state's responsibility because the state isn't doing their job. We're being guilted into providing that money. I don't think that's fair. No matter how good our charter schools is, I caution you to be very, very careful at looking at the current situation and what the implications are of taking those dollars and feeling like we have so much extra money that we can give it away, because we really don't, and we need to be careful. I actually voted against that when it came before the board, because at that time there was a last minute change that wasn't made transparent to the board. The amount changed the day of the board meeting. And I felt that I was perfectly fine sharing money with the charter schools the way it was presented. But at the last minute, there was a change. There was no room for discussion. It was take it or leave it. So I voted against it. I don't have a problem with it, but we have to make sure that we're doing it for the right reasons, not because we feel that we owe it to a certain constituency, because we have to be looking out for all our students.
We need to get something going. You know, we can have these nice talks, and you said, well, we talked about it last year. Well, let's put Carter to work. Let's get the legislature involved. If issues come up, if the state legislature changes the rules and the money that's going to the charter schools, if we have our contract written by a very competent attorney, by the way, we should be able to make some adjustments. And I think the charter schools would be willing to listen to that. You know, we don't have the money. We can't give it to them. We can't provide it to them. In this business of a 10-year capital outlay, we don't even have a 10-year capital outlay program here. I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years. We probably don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But, you know, it's just, we need to do something, even if it's wrong. We need to start looking at something.
Well, okay. And I don't disagree with Ms. Jimenez as far as being mindful of our debt load, but every time we talked about the administration building, all that kept being said was we don't have to borrow money to do it. But we don't have to borrow it again is the actual way that should be said. We've already borrowed it in COPS, certificates of participation. So I think we need to do that, and to Mr. Searcy's point, we need to make this right. I do know that Sebastian Charter Junior High has basically doubled their student load over the last few years through their capital project where they built a beautiful school. You know, they rose from a group of blue trailers to a state-of-the-art campus, and to be fair, they don't have to have the same requirements. And I do know that they're, you know, I'm a bit of a legislation wonk myself, and there are many bills in front that will be discussed this session. And one of them even says that perhaps providing districts with the ability to do more schools of innovation so that we're not under the same, that the district isn't under the same requirements that charter schools are, giving them some of the freedom. So, there are also dollars being set aside for charters in some of these for technology specifically. So we have to, you know, that's our job as board members to connect the legislature to the community, to the district. So I think that it makes perfect sense to work with Mr. Morrison on finding out what a right number would be and taking care of all the children in our district, whether they're in charter schools or traditional schools or, you know, we just had School Choice Week. And, you know, we need to take care of all our kids, is what I'm saying, so.
Ms. Simchuk?
Well, I had made a phone call to Mr. Morrison, but actually a quick talk to him, and he said he was to ask him what our financial status was. And he, again, we used Mr. Morrison to do this, and I'm sure he has other things to do, but mm-hmm. It is very important that we discuss this. So he told me he had that information today. Could we hear from him?
We do have some information available that shows the board where we are, where we were that at the time that we made gave the charter schools, you know, the one time, what the capital outlay picture looks like today. So, you know, we can do that today if you choose, or you can.
Yeah. If he's already done the work, let's hear.
Yeah. So, well, he's coming. Can I just ask a quick question? Besides, I did go to the charter school, high school. Graduation, and they did use the PAC, besides our PAC. Mm-hmm. What other things, like if we do speech therapy, are there special equipment that they use? I'm just wondering, are they using a lot of our capital things, or maybe Mr. Morrison has a little bit, I'm not sure, but are they using, you know what I'm saying, I know they use our football fields, our baseball fields, our lacrosse fields, if they have that. What else do they use of our capital? I mean, it's really...
Well, certainly if they participate in any of the extracurricular activities that the school district offers, you know, whether it's a coach or the uniform or the field or whatever, you know, that type of thing. In terms of other buildings, I think they probably could best tell us, but I'm not so aware of those type of things. But in the area of activities and sports and that type of thing, if they participate, then you bear the cost of that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today. What you have in your packet, well, primarily be referring to this little PowerPoint slide. This is condensing a lot of information into about four slides. However, but I wanted to discuss with you kind of where we are, a little history, show you what the collections over time were, etc. If you jump to page 2, in 2007-2008, you'll see the bar graph like this. The school district brought in over $36 million in the capital levy and collection. That's everything. And when you put that against our debt service at the time, our debt service was about $9.2 million, which is about 26% of that entire amount. And as you can see over time, where the real estate property prices have gone down, as well as the legislature has reduced our millage rate from 2 mils to 1.75 to 1.5, that half a mil today is still in the operating fund. They moved it over to finance the operating fund during the recession. So as you can see, over time, our debt service, as a percentage of how much capital dollars are bringing in 2013-14, It stands at about 59.25% of your millage levies and collections. So that kind of reiterates Mrs. Jimenez's point that you have about $116 million outstanding in certificate of participation that we have to meet that debt service. Over that time period, the district has lost over $16 million in capital millage revenues from 07-08 to where we are in 2013-14. And as the board members have pointed out, in 2009-10, we did share over $2 million in capital funds with the charter schools. On page 3, this is based on this year's budget, so we don't have actual figures as yet. The 1.5 mills levy is expected to bring in about $20,653,325. There's no disputing that at all. That's about, if you were to take your debt service, about 54% of your money. But as a whole, it's about 52.78%. You'll see that $11 million. When you look at PICO revenues, we have not received any PICO revenues for the last 4 years. In fact, this is the first year in the last 4 years that we've been able to get any money from the state. The governor's proposal in the General Appropriations Act raises the charter school revenues from $75 million last year to $100 million in 15-16. And that's about $100 million for about 200,000 students, whereas the traditional public schools go from $53 million to $60 million for 2.7 million kids. So what I wanted to show you is on the second half, or below the line, if you will, are items that we consider must fund. These are critical items that we have to do. So the first one, of course, is our debt service. You kind of want to pay your mortgage of $11 million. We have to pay our property casualty premium of about $1.3 million. We transfer approximately $2.1 million to the general fund for maintenance salaries on the salaries of our facility staff and all the materials and supplies that we need to go into maintaining our buildings. We have about $401 million worth of assets throughout the district that we have to maintain, over 3 million square foot of educational facilities. We also have portable classrooms, over $1 million. We'd love to replace them with permanent space, however, we just don't have those funds, so we budget about $1 million a year for portable leasing costs. The lease on this building for $45,000, and then sort of what's left, if you will, technology allocation, and I have a double star there to show that area I have on another slide is grossly underfunded, and I'll ask Mr. Green to come up and talk a little bit about how the millage is kind of helping us. The 0.6 millage is kind of helping us meet that need temporarily. And then the recurring capital maintenance dollars for your HVAC systems. Tonight we have a board agenda item trying to get that all fixed. Your ADA compliance issues, environmental issues, playgrounds, life, health, safety projects, etc. We put about $1 million into that on a recurring basis. So when you look at all your items that you have to do, you must fund, about 85.68 or almost 86% of those dollars are taken immediately off the top. On page 4, and if you could refer to, I call it the big sheet, this one, the planning document. This is the planning document that spreads out, if you will, for the next 5 years, all the projects by location, by estimated amounts that the school board has approved within the five-year plan. So the first line on page 4 of the PowerPoint slide is $500,000 for Citrus. We did not have all the dollars available at the time to do, and I've highlighted on the planning document for you over there.
Okay, right there. Yeah.
So in order to fund the remainder of the project at Citrus, we needed that $500,000 out of this year's budget. In 2015-16, we're also putting on that additional wing at Citrus. That's the $3 million that you see in the 15-16 line. And Beachland, the cafeteria, is coming online in 16-17. That's another $3 million that we've set aside. And as you can go look through the planning document, you can see all the schools and all the projects that are desperately needed at those schools. On page 202 of the planning document is just a breakdown of the recurring capital. It is not enough. However, we make do with those areas that we absolutely have to comply with. And then on back to page 4 of the PowerPoint are those projects that are kind of dispersed that I've summarized here for you, as well as a small projects listing that is the more detailed to the summarization. So on the small projects listing, for example, you have Dodgertown, $35,000, Highlands, you know, that so forth. You'll see all the projects that we have listed. By the way, these documents were shared with our principals. They have shared those with their SAC committee members, and they've shared these with their parents. So these are projects that have been publicly discussed and are out there. On page 5, I'd ask Mr. Green if you could come up and talk a little bit about the technology for me. And there is a backup document in your packet that looks at the status of technology funding for the recommended refresh cycle.
Good afternoon. So basically what this is showing recurring technology expenditure. So this is not moving forward with anything. This is not wiring. This is not infrastructure. These are the basic things we have to refresh on some type of a cycle. So what you'll see is you'll see the cycle we had pre-millage. Our computers were 7, 8, 9 years and basically until they failed. So we're trying with the millage to get on a 5-year cycle, and that's what we've been bringing to the board is computer purchases to get everything older than 5 years replaced. So if you look in the very far right column, you'll see the estimated capital dollars needed to maintain on a yearly basis those devices, and you'll see $3.56 million less the $500,000 budgeted in the capital. This is the far right bottom column. Leaves a need of $3 million a year. So what we're doing out of that 0.6 millage, there's 0.35 of it is for technology. So that roughly generates $4.7 million, I believe. So $3 million of that is going into just maintaining, trying to catch up and maintain the yearly equipment. And then the remaining is going into the one-to-one initiatives that you see and the wireless access points and the wiring closets that we talked about, the things that aren't included on here. So just wanted to... That list is basically recurring technology expenditures.
And in the far right column, if you spread that out over 5 years, which obviously we work on a 5-year basis... That's over $15.3 million that is underfunded just in the area of technology. I'll ask Mr. Ehrman if he could come up and discuss with us the recurring capital maintenance as well as the district-wide roofing issues.
Good afternoon. Life cycle analysis is done on a daily basis on not only on entire structures but also the district, even shingles, building components. You run into life cycle analysis whenever you are shopping for shingles. 15-year shingle versus a 30-year shingle, that 30-year is a little more expensive, so in your head you're doing a life cycle analysis. Basically what we did is took some industry standards from ASTM, which is a standardizing testing group. And what you're looking at on this page 11, the smaller sheet, is we took the total value of all the buildings in the school district, the book value of $445 million. And as a standard for office buildings and school buildings, 30% of the 30, if you use a 30-year life cycle, 30% of what you will spend on that building over 30 years is the initial cost of the building. So we took our book value and extended it to what you would spend on those buildings over 30 years, which is about $1.4 billion.
We then took 60% of that $1.4 billion, which is a standard for the cost of operating and maintenance of that building over a 30-year period. What we're doing is looking at where are we type thing. We're trying to generate a budget through economic analysis. So you come up with about over a 30-year period, your operating maintenance on the school district in the Inter County would be about $900 million. That does not include salaries for the people in the building. That's just to turn on the lights and such as that. So then what we did is built a little table and took remaining years of useful life from today of 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years, and 80 years. So what you do is you take your $891 million and you divide it by 30 years and you get $29 million a year right across. Follow the same type of formula there. Our utility costs, our maintenance costs, support services costs, administration costs, custodial costs, all add up to about $10.5 million a year. And that's basically what it costs to operate all the buildings in the district. So if you take your 10.5 minus the $29 million, the top number, you come down to about $19 million. We then, in the capital budget, you may have seen about $3 million a year, which was that remainder. So what that means is that if all of our buildings were to extend out 30 years from today, we're running about $16 million a year in the negative on what we should be spending on. So what we're doing is back solving for how long do our buildings have to last. Mm-hmm. So if you go over there to the year 70, you finally break even, so to speak. So what this tells us is that our buildings, that some are now much older than they are, than 70 years, they would be 100 years old by the time we broke even on it, if they lasted that long.
At the current spending levels.
At the current spending levels. So what that's telling you is not a specific number, it's just telling you we're way behind on where we should be spending on our own buildings.
Is this the University of Florida study?
University of Florida has done studies like this on school districts for the Florida Department of Education, ASTM, the Building Land Institute. This is a very common type of analysis that's done on buildings, and it's a good way to gauge how you're doing on your buildings. If, for example, you had a building that was designed to be a 50-year building, which is what we designed the buildings for in the district, and you were taking care of it, you were spending on it like it was a 100-year building, you would start seeing things like severe degradation of the building. You know, in other words, you're not keeping up with the infrastructure. And at some point, you just can't spend enough. Whenever the pipes start breaking under the slab, or whenever the pipes start breaking in the walls, that's time. Now you're looking at big bills, and you're in emergency mode. And we have buildings that are in emergency mode right now. Friday, we were at Oslo Middle with broken vent stacks inside block walls. We were letting sewer gas into classrooms. So we have immediate needs. And what will happen is, as time progresses, if you don't keep up, that infrastructure crumbles faster than you can repair, and the repairs become much more expensive. And we don't want to come to the board and say we need a large chunk of money for an emergency repair. Okay. Two years ago, we had a roofing engineers come through and do a survey of all of our roofs and give us a budget matrix for what we should be doing. We're now in the second year of that, and we're going to get started spending on it pretty soon. We do about $500,000 a year in roof leak repairs right now. We're bleeding operating funds. We need new roofs, and we're going to have to move that up to a priority. The problem is that when you move that up to a priority, something else suffers right now. So it's a P, move the P's around.
So to summarize, on page 5, you will see that we're underfunded in its entirety of about $10.2 million today. And spread that out over 5 years, that's over $51 million that we're underfunded in our 5-year capital plan. And then finally, you have a handout attached to your packet. We call this the Can't Afford List. This is the list of... Is that me? Not me. This is a list of items that, based on our walkthroughs of the schools and the capital needs that we have identified, throughout the school district. These are the things that need to be done, and obviously we do not have the money to undertake these projects. And you'll see the total at the back on page 6, at the very back of the... That's adding up for all of the schools. So that is just the information that we have today to assist you in making your decision. We clearly acknowledge that we have needs, the charter schools have needs, but my role, as you said, is to put me to work, which I have been doing, to give you the information to assist you in your decision.
So as always, Carter provides you with a lot of information and a lot of detailed information. I think the chart on the front is probably the clearest picture of what has happened over the years in terms of capital outlay money that the district once received, and what we now receive and what our debt is and what's left to spend. So, the goal is just to give you information so you know where we are as a school district. So as you move forward to ask for additional information and options, you know where we stand.
Ms. Hochek?
Thank you. I have some questions. This is the first time I've seen these. Can you please tell me where? Obviously, when you have a five-year capital outlay plan, as we have had through these projects listed in this large pullout, where is the reserve that's carried over? What is our capital reserve, that we carry over to complete these projects? Can you point that exactly?
On page 2 of 2, you see that zero line? That's what the reserve is. All dollars are spoken for, if you will, for the next 5 years. What you will see on occasion when we bring forward the budget book to you is that you will have a project that has been funded, but it may cross the fiscal year. So although the dollars have been committed, not all the purchase orders have been issued. Sometimes you have long lead items, you got to buy chillers, those kinds of things. So you will see, and it's a very misleading thing that the board has asked us to try to do, not call it fund balance. And what we've tried to do in the budget book is call it project commitments not yet encumbered in the budget. Okay? And then we have roll forward of those dollars. So although you may have a budget for something, you haven't issued all your purchase orders, your contracts have not been done yet, and it crosses the fiscal year. So it looks like we have this large fund balance, but it's really dollars that have been committed to these projects that have not been spent yet.
Okay, follow up. So I'm going to ask a better question. With the total funded projects cost above the zero line, that is the amount set aside per year. So 2014-2015 totaling down is $4,120,379 spoken for and set aside for all our projects.
For those small projects, yes. For
just
those small projects and also those projects that are listed from the front of the page.
So
all of that adds up to 4 million.
Total funded projects each year consecutively is that bottom line above the zero?
Yes.
Thank you.
Just a basic question. Should our viewing audience wish to access these? They're up on the website or they're...
They were put on the administrator's website because we had shared those with the principals and so forth.
Okay.
I checked the website, the public website, and I realized that we did not put them up at the time. So I will make sure for you guys for anybody who wants to access them, we'll put them on the website.
Thank you.
Everything
much.
I present here today,
great.
I can do that.
Would it be fair to ask a question? Do you suppose with all this that the charter schools might have any of these needs? I mean, technology and building and roof and parking lot. And I don't know much about that charter school, but I would think they probably would have the same kind of issue. But the bottom line, Mr. Chairman, we need to get to looking at this thing. And what bothers me just a bit, as these property values have continued to go down, our debt has continued to go up. So this last year, it looked like it took a little dip in there.
It wasn't just property values.
It was a combination.
We went from 0.0 mil to 1.75 mil
right.
1 year.
To
and 1.5.
Then
1.5.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just property values.
Just directed on that.
Well, it's a combination of two things.
That's right.
It's a decline in property value and the millage. It was 2.0 on the property value.
Mm-hmm.
and then the legislature says, well, we don't have enough money over here in operating, so we're going to decrease this by a quarter mil, increase that by a quarter mil.
And I did it
and
again.
And did that twice 2 years in a row.
But we have continued to just increase our debt.
The major change in the debt profile or debt stock of the district is the $26 million that we issued in qualified school construction bonds during the recessionary period. And we issued $26.2 million at a rate of about 5.91%. However, we receive a federal subsidy, a check essentially, for 5.83%, I think it is. So you get paid back for the interest. Because, and if you look at the, we all focus on the liability side of the ledger, so to speak, but on the asset side, we were able to construct a two-story building at Fellsmere to accommodate those student stations, as well as Treasure Coast. We're able to add the wing and do some work there. So that is the major change in the debt profile of the school district throughout those years.
Ms. Mass?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we get sometimes as board members, we get caught up just looking at the numbers, but those numbers translate into an investment in the buildings and the facilities that house our students. And so, yes, we have borrowed money, but the money that has been borrowed has been to build cafeterias and to expand schools where we were busting at the seams. And, you know, I understand, as I said earlier, absolutely, if you looked at charter schools, they have those same needs. But the way the statute is written, their capital needs are their responsibility. And if the state is not funding them accurately, basically what we need to do is we need to look at this list and say, what are we not going to provide the traditional public schools? So, you know, and that's what this board will have to do. If you decide to move forward with this, you will have to sit here, look at this, and say, which school, Dodgertown, Gifford Middle, Vero Beach High School, which HVAC are you not going to repair? Which security cameras are you not going to put in the schools? Because your priority is to fund charter schools, which are public schools and which have our children, but which the state is not being responsible for. So if you would like to do that, the board majority can choose to do that. And you explain to your traditional schools why you are taking money from their buildings, from their security, to do something the state isn't doing. I agree, the state should be funding charter schools the way they need to be funded, but they're not doing it. And it doesn't become our problem by default. I'm sorry, I just don't see the logic. If we didn't have expenses, I guess one of the questions I have that has shocked me, and I was circling them all, how is it possible that we have in the wish list security cameras at all our schools pretty much when one of our priorities in the capital plan was safety for students? That totally blows my mind, because I had assumed that at least that priority, which is student safety, would be taken care of. So before we start giving out our money, why don't we focus? And again, it's no disrespect to charters. I see all the principals making faces back there. I understand your pain, but you know what? That's not our responsibility. You guys get to play by your rules, and that's one of the consequences. Everything has consequences. You get the FTEs. The state doesn't do right by you. It shouldn't fall on us, and we shouldn't be made to feel like we're the bad guys. Now, you do have a board majority that can make that choice, but I ask my board members, my colleagues, which schools are you not going to support so that you can support your constituency? Because that is an important question. So what happened to our security cameras?
We have an answer.
Good afternoon. Just to quickly address the security cameras, when we allotted the $2 million for the security budget.
Mike.
Oh, sorry.
Over there. When we allotted the $2 million.
And fencing.
Well, when we allotted the $2 million for the security project that we undertook district-wide, it included a three-phase approach. One was first phase, and we actually did bring architects in that were certified in school safety and design. The first thing that you have to do is secure your perimeter. You have to control access. So our first priority was to put up the fencing that was required to get the security measures in place. The second thing that we had to do was to create a single point of entry. So once we secured the perimeter, we still had some obligations to direct the people to that single point of entry where we can monitor who's coming and going. And then the third phase was to get the security cameras at some of the schools, such as the elementary schools that in the past haven't had security cameras. What we found was the money that was allotted, we didn't know what we were going to have to spend. We didn't know exactly what our condition was. We had the assessment done, and we found out that we had a shortfall. So we were able to accomplish, for the most part, phase one district-wide. In some places, we were able to accomplish phase two. But only at the high schools and a couple of the middle schools were able to accomplish phase three, which was the cameras. So
more dollars would have to be set aside to move ahead to put all of those systems in.
It seems like that would be an important priority, and we need to have a number. I didn't circle all of them, but I thought we circled at least eight schools. So what does that translate to? How do we address it? Because that's our student safety.
Typically, we would bring that forward at the capital planning.
Yeah, I think that's a discussion for another day. Let's try to focus on this. Mr. Frost?
I just had a couple questions. How does the recent restructure affect this? I noticed this only goes through 2013-14.
Yes. So I actually brought... We would recommend to you...
And while we're thinking about that, is the assumed residual value of any given building over its lifetime zero at the end?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's down to zero.
Fully depreciated.
Fully depreciated, okay.
So what you're looking at is the prior debt service, and this is the 2005 COP that we recently refinanced.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the present value savings and the yearly savings. We would recommend to you, based on what we've talked about here today regarding technology, our roofings, the security camera initiatives, and the security, that those funds be directed to those projects. Again, that's just a recommendation. The board has the power to do whatever way you want to do that.
Ms. Sherrison?
What is the term on our COPs?
The maximum they go out to is 18 years. Most of them are like 20 years. I think the 07 is a 20-year, I believe.
Would there be any benefit to the district to refinancing on a long-term basis for all of our capital?
Looking for 10 years.
There's a call provision on your bonds that when you issue them, you cannot call them in, take them away from the investors, and refinance them for the first 10 years.
And we just did that.
For the 05.
We'll be doing it again in 2 years.
We'll be doing it for the 07 COP, assuming interest rates are attractive.
Would there be any benefit as far as debt servicing for the district in spreading that out over a longer term? I mean, you put a number in here that we've got to spend the next number of $1 million each year to repay our debts. But if you spread that out over 30 years or whatever you can get, would there be any benefit to the district and our budget, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, when you guys put it together, it's always balanced.
Typically, when you refinance and extend your debt out, you pay more interest as opposed to principal up front.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, it's going to cost you more to spread it out over that 30-year period.
If you pay according to the term, but if you spread it out, you can pay in advance. I mean, if we have good legal counsel, and they allow our note to be so that we can prepay. You have the term spread out so you don't have to.
We don't have that provision.
There are some provisions, but again, it's going to be subject to what the bondholders will buy, and
right. There's
no call provision in the first 10 years, so you cannot pay extra on your mortgage
If you had permanent financing, if in 2 years we've got to go through the COP thing again and redo the bonds with whoever the investors are, but if instead of going through COPs, we actually go out for long-term financing.
Okay, are you talking about you're referring to it like a GO bond, a general obligation?
I was talking about long-term financing as opposed to this COP financing. But the problem with that, from what I understand, you have to actually go to the voters to get that approval, right? Is that why we've gone to the COPs, or?
Can I ask a question? Are you asking that so that we take on more long-term debt so that we give Charter money?
Instead of renewing the COPs in 2 years, mm-hmm. go out for long-term financing and take that COP money, whatever, however many million it is, and spread it out over 30 years or some long-term like that.
For a savings to give Charter? Is that
No. Just for our debt service purpose. Then. I guess we could do anything we want to with the savings, but our budget is balanced every year, and we still are coming up short.
We are required to submit a balanced budget to the state, but what I'm showing you here are areas that are severely underfunded, and we're not meeting our needs, and we're not meeting the required upkeep, so to speak.
What is the answer?
Well, I'd have to do an analysis, but just thinking off the top of my head, if you issued the debt in 07 and you're now in 017, you're 10 years in, so the remainder, the other 10 years, you're not going to spread it out to 30 years. You are going to pay more, just off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. You are going to pay more interest mm-hmm. because you're now converting 10-year debt remaining balance into 30-year debt, depending upon the interest rate, of course. Mm-hmm. So the net present value, I think you're going to end up paying more interest.
Anyone have anything else?
Just we talked a little bit about the roofs and financing and how we have a 5-year capital plan and how some more progressive districts who are a little different financial thinking have forecasted, and they know that the useful life of a roof is 25 years, and then they do a pro rata share, today's net present value of that roof, and then each month they set aside enough money to fix that roof when it comes time to do so. It would seem as though if we were to look at our borrowing habits, perhaps funding something along those lines so that we're adequately funding our building so that we're not spending $500,000 a year on patch jobs, which have secondary property damage. There are a number of factors. So we're being a bit more proactive that if we are borrowing money, that we're borrowing it at favorable rates, and at the same time doing it in such a fashion where we're saving money through our operating model so that we know what a roof costs, we're borrowing enough to fix it when it's time to fix it, and that we're not constantly chasing our tail. And it seems as though we're taking sort of a buy here, pay here approach to our finances.
A couple things. The property values that we use to forecast for the 5 years are supplied to us from the state, the Legislative Office of Economic and Demographic Research. Dr. Amy Baker, who is the state's economist, she heads that division. And they only go out that far in terms of what the revenues, they estimate the property tax values to be. And, of course, nobody's forecast a recession, obviously. So that's one thing. It's difficult to go out 10 years to match the life of your assets to the revenues. So I think that's something that we've talked about internally, to go out 10 years. And that's difficult to put all those revenues together for that extended period. The second thing I want to remind the board, and there are some new board members here, that with the old board we had discussed leveraging in our operating fund through performance contracting. We have currently now two contracts with FPNL and also Con Edison. Because we have no capital dollars, we're leveraging through our operating fund, through leases, how we were going to address some of these situations that we have in our schools. So I just want to remind you that that was something that we brought to you as an option in looking at trying to address some of these needs.
Anything else? Are we going to move ahead with it and try to get something going, or is it just a discussion end of game?
Depends on how the board wants to move forward.
Okay.
To do what?
To consider exactly what we're talking about and see if we can find a way to provide a capital money to the charter schools.
Ms. Sinclair?
Okay. We're clearly just told we were out of money. Charters has received funds
that we did not. This process was done before, one time. North County is growing, and I sit on the Fellsmere and Sebastian Planning and Zoning as a liaison in the schools. Fellsmere is claiming they'll need 3 elementaries and 1 middle school. They want a high school, but I don't see that. We won't need another middle school up in the North County, as far as I know. I know we want to be fair. But did I mention we were just told we're out of money? So I was, before today, seeing as an item on the agenda, I agree with you, 10-year capital outlay was, you know, we don't do that ourselves, really. Yeah, I'm sure they do in theory after 5, but 5 is there. I thought, and again, we are very involved, and it involves our people, our time, and our soft-term dollar to review all this. My main priority right now for me, and I'm only speaking for me, not the board corporate, is the superintendent search. So I thought if somebody wanted to perhaps have each charter, because we have a new charter school up there that shouldn't have a lot of capital outlay. I also know that they had a financial issue, self-imposed, and took in 5th graders from another charter, their feeder school, took some students away from them. So there's, you know, they have their issues, we have ours, but I would have maybe been open to hearing after the superintendent search, maybe having them prepare, because when they come in, we have to have our work, and again, I'm not willing to invest their time in that short-term dollar. Maybe listen to what their capital outlay plans are and justifications. To listen. That's a start. To listen. That's where I was today before I found out we were out of money and in the hole for projects. And again, as Ms. Mena says, what student, what school, what are we taking away? But that's where I was before we came in, was to say, not now. I want to go through the cap, you know, this. I don't know what everybody else is doing, but I'm telling you, I'm working through the long hours on going through those resumes and making phone calls. And I cannot take on another project and, you know, plan another meeting to have the charter schools come in and present that.
That's not what I'm talking about. We need to find out what we can do. We don't need to know what their needs are yet. We need to know if we can, if we will even consider sharing any of our capital dollars with the charter schools.
Ms. Mann?
The challenge here is that we were just told that we don't have all this money that everybody thinks we have. You know, there's a perception that the school district has some slush fund somewhere and that we refuse to use that money. And our chief financial officer has explained that, yes, because we have to balance the budget, it looks like we're getting everything done. But the reality is we're spending the money we get and we are still at a deficit. So I would have a hard time. Right now, we are busy with the superintendent search. What I would prefer to do is figure out what we can do to get our needs met for our students. And, of course, you know, legislatively, the governor is looking for ways to fund charter schools. We're finally getting some PICO dollars, which we didn't get before because it was given to the charter schools. So, you know, this is a very complex thing, and I understand that all our children deserve the best school environment they can have. But we need to listen to the information that we got. I have a hard time understanding how, knowing that we're in the red, we're going to say to our charter schools, we're going to try to meet your needs, too, when we know that we're not even doing the basic work that we need to do to fund our schools for the traditional schools. So I'm kind of there with you, Ms. Simchek. I think we need to get over the superintendent search. I don't think we should be making promises or hinting at promises that the numbers will not support. I think that's a dangerous game to play to get people's hopes up when we can't even meet the needs of our school, especially when it comes to security. Security is so important for our students.
Well, I keep hearing our schools and things along those lines. I consider charter schools to be our schools. They are our students. They are our community. I mean, they're they're the fastest growing population we have is in charter schools. So it's just a philosophical point that I feel we need to move from but to and, you know, to embrace charter as being part of that. And I feel as though there's this adversarial situation that's been set up, and we even identified it in our superintendent requirements that we need someone who's going to heal that relationship, and you know, we do need to my mind, I think we do probably need to get past that before we really revisit this, you know, the superintendent piece. So that's the last one.
All right.
The only one we haven't heard from is you.
Well, my job is to facilitate you.
Well, now what?
Well, I'm not, what I keep, and I was going to speak here again once everybody's had their chance. You know, I was part of the board back in 2011 when we did go forward with this. At that point, you know, it was a priority. And the board, you know, not three members said yes, it was a priority. And we did. I agree with the theory of it, and I do want to readdress it this summer. But between now and then, what I want to get a good handle on, with the help of financial people, whoever that may be, I like to think that, you know, I understand finances, but it's a complicated issue, and I want to know exactly. I want to know what charter schools have been funded. What are they currently being funded? And also, what's going to come out of this legislative session? Mm-hmm. You ask one person, the charter schools don't get anything, capital. You ask another person, oh, yeah, they get this much. You know, I know they were getting PICO dollars. What? I just want to get a really good handle on what the charter school capital funding situation is. You know, right now, what it's going to, how it's going to be affected, if at all. You know, to me, this whole thing of can you afford to do it, that was a little ahead of itself for me. That's you know, that's next. You know, I'm not even there yet. You know, it's just kind of, it's great information, a lot of fun numbers, but that's over here. First of all, I want to get a good handle on, I have a good handle on capital outlay for traditional public schools. I can talk to you about it for quite a while. I won't, but I could. What I want to get a good handle on, a better handle on, is the capital funding for our charter schools. So whoever can make that magic happen, either the charter schools themselves, you know, anybody who's willing to show me some information, I'd be willing to listen. And I want to get a hold of that first. And that's kind of where I am. I don't think we're ready to move forward with anything at this point. That's where personally I think I am. I know, you know, I was told a story back in, I think, 2010 when we did this the first time. You know, I visited Martha School up there, and Hal McAdams is standing knee-deep in what should have been the bathroom, mm-hmm. you know, and he was standing underneath the floor. You know, and some pictures like that, he's like, yeah, we need to do something to help these folks. But number one is, how are they funded now? Number two is, what are their needs? Then we get into what you can afford. Okay? Does that make sense to anybody?
That's the reasonable process that I'm talking about, Mike. And I agree with the team check about, you know, getting the superintendent's thing over with. But what we've got at some point, we've got to decide, well, yes, maybe we do need to bring this up at some later date. But not just forget about it. I don't want to do that.
And just to reaffirm, that is my position, that we can have the charter schools. It's just like a car salesman, and then you have to investigate what kind of car you want to buy. You have to have both sides of the story. Mm-hmm. And I can't, right now, get our side from our people and digest those numbers while I'm doing all this background and making sure that our leader, I'm not saying I would have been willing to put it on you know, sometime in June, and that if we could get that information at a later date, because like you said, and you can push a number, and I do know that, I'm aware on that, that's why I asked, you can push that number out, and are those, so it, you know, as long as you have money, it's going to be there and you're going to push it out, but there are jobs slated, and those are jobs that really need to be done. So it's, to answer your question, this is something we all, you know, a lot of us are very much in favor of. But the time that's going to be needed to properly investigate this, for me, is not right now. Just for me. Because I'm sure we'll get two different, we're going to have to find out, you know, and that's why we pay people this money. To get that money, to hold on to our district, and to hold it safe.
And then we are the liaisons and also the partners in the community to say, okay, we've got to pull away from a little bit and we have to be fair. And I agree and I applaud you for bringing it up. And I am in favor of that at a specific time. But right now, because of the situation, I can't digest that. But I'm willing to digest it. I mean, we should have somebody hired by May. And I'm willing to sit and, because that's a lot of, and this was a lot.
Yeah,
that
a lot of information.
I just first saw. So it's an end. I would like to hear the charter schools side of it too.
We just need to find a way.
And I think the way would be, as Mr. McCain said, the summer.
Big old used
car wash. Thanks, Sam. Oh,
we can have those.
Really, wellness policy.
All right, that's right.
All right, Mr. Menendez, you were next.
Yes. I wanted to refer back to the policy that I mentioned this morning during the student code of conduct. The policy 5610.05, and it actually is in your board books. So it is an opportunity, if the board members are willing to take a look at it, there will be a hearing. We're setting the hearing for that March 24th, I think it is, at tonight's board meeting. And if you go back and you look at that policy, there are really no procedures attached to it, and that's why I question the language and ask that there be due process for the students, because there is no process that you can go back to and say, look, we did our due diligence and we decided to say no. There is no process. And so there's no process, and there's no due process for the family if they decide. So I would ask you to take a look at that, because when that, I don't want to have to do it at the meeting to pull it then. I really think that if the board corporate looks at it and decides they want to eliminate it, but that means that if you eliminate that sentence, there has to be some kind of language for what's the appeal process going to be. So that's really up to staff to do, but I think we need to kind of give direction so that can be done, so that by the hearing, any changes are made and we don't have to pull it at that time. So, Dr. Adams, any thoughts on that?
What I would like to do is to bring that policy forward so you can have the full background on,
great,
you know, where we were with that at the next discussion session, if that's okay. And that way I'll give you all the background and we'll...
Can you just give me the number I wrote down?
Yeah, it's 5610.05 and it's page 252 of 308 in your board book.
And tonight, aren't we just setting the public hearing date?
Yeah.
So we would have
so
time
we've got time in between.
Yeah, that's
to do
why
that.
I'm bringing it up.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
The policies as they exist at the time of advertisement for your rulemaking public hearing are the policies that you will be asked to adopt. Any revisions to those policies that may occur between the time of the advertisement and the public hearing to adopt are then subject to a supplemental procedure where we have to advertise the amendment, and the time period then pushes another 30 days for that advertisement. So by all means, absolutely, you have the ability to change language. I just want to make you aware that at your final public hearing, if you make those changes, they won't actually be adopted until we have another 30-day advertisement period. It's the fun of rulemaking under Florida law.
But it's that policy.
Yes, it's just that on that policy. You can do everything else, and then that one policy pushes.
We can revise any policy anytime with proper notification.
Yes, sir. Yes,
so
sir.
So next discussion, I'll bring that forward,
okay,
and
you.
We'll have a. We'll decide whether we want to make any changes on it.
All right. Dale, you next.
Okay. I need to ask, is Mr. Frost attending the breakfast?
That one's,
which one's that?
At the...
What day was that?
Because
the
of the sunshine law
right.
issue, which was the
it's,
the
it's
John
the moonshine,
Island.
Oh. Because they can't advertise it
right.
there, so
their
we can't have more
doesn't.
Than one.
So I had gone to the first one, and I believe you were slotted for the...
I think it's February 24th,
the, reason
the
I
morning of the board meeting.
I have accepted a private invitation to a closed club, Grand Harbor Club, for the Moonshot Moment for a lunch Monday, February 23rd.
Okay.
I am attending.
And then you're going to attend on the 24th?
Yes.
Okay.
I RSVP'd, so I'm just saying that because does that fall in the same category? It's a private club.
Yes.
It's a moonshot moment.
They won't allow public access.
They don't allow public access. It's like John's Island.
And what is the topic of debate or topic of discussion or what is
the same as the breakfast? It's a lunch and learn moonshot moment.
A lunch and learn. So there's a presentation being given by a board member
or community member and staff member.
A school district staff member, mm-hmm. but it's a closed.
Yes, it's the same thing.
For them, it's closed.
The same thing you told us we couldn't both be at the same breakfast.
Because this is more than just a social event. I mean, this is like a seminar being put on by the
information sharing.
So right.
in case anyone else was going to attend and RSVP'd simultaneously, and we got there that day on the advice of our attorney.
They don't invite us for our next appointments like that.
I don't.
If Fat Boys had something, I'd probably go to that.
On the sunshine list.
And I'm not going to eat breakfast unless one of y'all is going to come over and take my kids to school that morning. Okay.
Well, they canceled all my. We're not at committee meetings, are we?
Not yet.
Okay. That's it. I don't have anything.
I've already done the superintendent search. Mr. Searcy?
My point that I wanted to bring up was just the segregation order, compliance, where we stand on the matter. My understanding, we've been in. Under this order for 45 years, and we're still not in compliance. And it sort of pains me just a little bit to be sitting at the board table up there and have somebody come up and say, well, you know, you have to consider in this superintendent search that you're under a desegregation order. Well, we either need to get it on or get it off. And I don't know what we can do to get it. You know, if you look at the numbers for the different schools, a number of them are out of compliance. How do we get them into compliance, number one? Is it really all about the children, the students? I don't really think so. I really don't think so. And so I would like for us to figure out a way to either get the judge to look at it, get it done, and get us out from. I don't know how many other school districts in the state are under this kind of order, but it just doesn't make sense for this school district, as fine as it is, to always be under the gun of this order, this judge's order. A judge has been dead for I don't know how many years. It's not helping our students. It's not helping anything that I can see. For us to still be under this order, especially since it's not working. So I don't know what you guys think about it, guys and gals.
Ms. Subject?
I applaud you for looking at this, the first thing I looked at. But there's so many problems with that because people move, people migrate, we move boundaries of, you know, zoning. And so either get it on or get it off, the philosophy. Well, to get it off, we can't. And I'll tell you why. Because, wait a minute, I talked to the attorney. You would have to prove. Well, I shouldn't speak to you. Maybe you could explain why it would be difficult to get it off, because that's what I asked.
That's a better answer.
From the way she told me, I'm just, you know.
And we have some data to share when you're ready, so you can look at it by school to know why we're not in compliance, but go ahead.
In answer to Mr. Searcy's first question about how many districts in the state of Florida are still under desegregation plan, it's 8 or 9 at this point. I want to say, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I think the school board received a presentation regarding possibly going for unitary status and getting out from underneath the desegregation order. At that point, I think there were 16 districts, so slowly some have fallen off. But there are still 8 or 9, and Indian River is one of those. The most recent one that got out from under their desegregation order is Jefferson County, which is up in the Panhandle. But there, you have to understand, some districts are very unique. In Jefferson County School District, they've got one elementary school, they've got one middle school, they've got one high school. So it was very, I don't want to say easy. I mean, none of it's easy, but it was a more simple process when you just have three, you know, one school at each level to, you know, completely balance your district. So I want to bring that to your attention, but I think their situation is very, very different than what you're dealing with here in Indian River. To get out from underneath a desegregation order, you have to be able to prove to the federal judge, we have to reopen the case, which is easy enough to do, and prove to the federal court system that you have complied, good faith compliance, for a significant or that's a substantial period of time with the requirements of your desegregation order. So everyone's order is different. We would look strictly to what your order requires and establish that compliance. So we have to look back at our previous, what we've done in the previous years, as well as look forward of what our plan is, you know, going forward to maintain it. So that is going to be the data, if you will, that the district, I mean, lawyers can't do that. The district will need to establish that data. And the desegregation order lists a number of areas. Some were very, you know, I don't want to say easy. Again, I don't want to say easy, but it was easier to comply. Facilities, I mean, that's something that, I mean, you've had some discussion about it, but that was something that you were easily able to accomplish. Transportation, the court has even said there was really no need for any, you know, great transportation. It really had to do with students, you know, your populations of students being balanced amongst your schools and staff, both at administrative level and at, you know, in the classroom level. So that's the data that would have to be studied. In order to go into court, of course, we don't know what the other side to this case will do. We don't know if they will go in with us, arm in arm, let's get this done and get out from underneath it, maybe, or if they will go in opposing. We want this desegregation order to remain in place. We like it. Around the state, I think if you speak to other school board members, you will hear a mixed bag. In Jefferson County, the most recent one, the parties went in together. They said, you know, we are in lockstep on what we need to do, what we've done, and so it was basically them going in together to get it taken off the books. Orange School District also a couple years ago went through their unitary status, and the parties were not in lockstep. They fought about it for a couple of years. I want to say it was Pinellas School Board. The parties were not together, and they fought about it for years. When you ask about cost, because it requires district time, of course, to gather the data, we need expert witnesses that we need to come in that have done this sort of thing, so there'll be those dollar costs. The couple of school districts who have successfully gotten out from underneath their desegregation order when it was a fight with the opposing side, there are a few lawyers based in Washington, D.C. that were brought in to consult on it. That is certainly an option. Years ago, we actually got the cost of what other districts spent, about between $500,000 to close to $1 million, depending upon experts and how long you fight these battles. But I think, you know, before, you know, we think about court, I think there needs to be a hard look at your data. Where are you and where have you been? If there have been some slip-ups in complying with the plan, do we know why? And your plan actually provides you with a way to explain why. Your desegregation order allows you to say, we have to have a certain percentage of staff at a certain percentage level across all schools. But it says if you don't meet it in any one year, you can provide information that says we made offers to 10 people and not one of them accepted. So that would be, I mean, that's data. I don't know how you keep that data, but that's data that you could pull, if it's possible, and then use to say, you know what, this year we didn't meet it, but we we made offers to all these people. They just didn't want to come teach on the beach, I love that.
Did you see that video?
I mean, I thought it was great. I thought it was a great video. It really rises and falls on your data. And then once we know where we are as far as your compliance for a period of time, and then moving forward what our plan is to stay in compliance, then I think you'd be in a better position to say, by date X, we want to go back into court and give it the college.
If a judge couldn't look at that plan from 1964 and see that we've made substantial progress, there's something wrong with it. So, I mean, I'm complimenting the district. At the same time, whatever I'm saying, we just need to get rid of the plan. But, you know, it's just... we need to look at, and I don't want to use a scare tactic that what might be. I wasn't.
No, of course not.
I mean, you, I was actually. But,
that's okay.
It might cost $500,000. I don't know what it's costing. But let's, you know, at least we ought to get with the fine folks that are on the other side and visit with them and explain to them the progress that's been made, the steps that we're taking to try to make sure that there's no discrimination in hiring and students and all that business, and see where we are. You know, we might
yes,
be able to walk arm in arm down to the judge and say, we're ready to get out from under. But
yes,
just sitting around, you know, 45 years and not doing anything doesn't make sense to me.
Suzanne, what kind of argument can they make around our student achievement and our gap with our minority students? I mean, I know that there's a piece in that DSEG order about academics, and the word on the street is that we fail our African-American students. That may be true, it may not be true, but that's what people are hearing. And I think part of that challenge that we have is collecting that data and telling that story about where we're going in terms, you know, today we heard a little bit about disproportionate minority contact in terms of suspensions and expulsions, and that there are some schools that still face those challenges. So I think it's a bigger picture, and we've come a long way, but there's still a lot of work to do, and I think that that's part of what holds us back. What role does that play in it?
It's possible. It's possible. I don't want to say that it absolutely will. That what the court opinions say is that the courts are allowed to consider. There's a list of things that the court has to look at, okay? Facilities and student populations and staff populations. But they could, if they wished, also look at something that the courts call quality of education in determining whether a district has fulfilled its desegregation obligation. So it could come up, but it says quality of education. It doesn't say achievement gap. So, you know, if I were the lawyer standing there, I would say this quality of education is the students at this school use the math curriculum that the students at this school use. The teachers at this school are comparable to the teachers at this school. So that the quality of what's being offered has been, you know, made even across the board. I mean, that's the argument I would make. But, I mean, a good lawyer on the other side will say, something doesn't work with your argument because this school is way up here and this school is way down there. You know, so I think it's certainly an issue that will be brought up or could be brought up. It's just going to be the element is quality of education, and if we can establish on our side that it is across the board, everyone gets the same quality, but for whatever reason, some students don't take that information and then achieve with it, they achieve less than others. But I agree. I think that could possibly be something that's brought up, certainly.
Because, you know, what I'm thinking is maybe if this is something that we want to pursue, that it might be worthwhile for us as a board to, after we're finished with the superintendent search, have an opportunity to go back, look at the documents, look at the revised order, and then at a discussion session, look at the data. Because we collect this data on a yearly basis. And it would be interesting to see what the trends are and what the school district is doing to comply. My question would be for the schools that have unitary status, that have gained it recently in the time of charter schools. My question is, when you have a lot of charter schools that are not in compliance, what is the school district's responsibility? Because for the new board members of my first term on the board, I tried to get some accountability placed into the actual contracts for the charter schools, that they show their best effort for recruiting diversity, and they refused it. And they were able to lobby the board to shoot that addition to the contract down. And when you look at the demographics of our charter schools, you know, our charter schools do well,
like a lot of our magnet schools do well because they're very homogeneous. They attract a certain population, and that's the elephant in the room that we don't talk about. When you look at cities like New York City, you look at Atlanta, you look at other communities where you have charter schools, they tend to serve at-risk students. And when you look at the research for charter schools, actually, that's one of the groups that they serve the best. When they work with at-risk students, that's when they're most successful. In our school district, that's not the problem. We're not a big city. We're a small community. And so I wonder how that pans out, because when it comes to that, this board has not been willing to have any oversight around making sure that that recruitment is fair. And, you know, and it's not, you can't force kids to go to charter schools, right? You just have to show, because that's what the courts want. They want to show best effort. And when I tried to move modifying the contract so they would show best effort, the board said no thank you, and the charter school said no thank you. And that could be something that could come back to haunt this board, because those are our schools. And those schools, some of them, I mean, some of the schools are pretty diverse if you look at the numbers, but not all of them. Okay. And that is an ongoing challenge, because we can't force that. In the school district, we try to force it by making sure the magnet schools are, you know, make allowances so that they can be diverse, but we can't force the charter schools to do that. So that, we have five charter schools. I haven't seen the most recent data, so I don't know what the diversity looks like, but I know that in the past, the diversity hasn't been there.
Four and five are out at the college.
Yep.
Yeah, so four out of five.
Four out of five. Right.
And we refuse to hold them accountable.
Right.
Go figure. That's not going to look good for us.
I don't disagree. And I actually think I was on the board at a charter school at the time where that was going through. And I know that there were efforts being made to recruit. But again, you can't force, and you know, there are busing constraints and all sorts of transportation constraints. I know that that's a big piece of it. So, and again, not every board thinks the same way that board did. So you're right, we would have to make some sort of allowances for the charters to be in compliance too. That could be a sore spot.
And when it comes all down to it, it's not a lot of students. You know, you have very small charter schools, actually. I mean, the Charter
True.
High and the Imagine are the largest, but you're not talking about a lot of students. You might be talking about three. You know what I mean? It's not a big number. But while it's, you know, in a way some of them are very diverse, it's not a lot of students that you would be talking about. I do have some data, so I think we ought to give it to you anyhow, because Mr. Susi did bring it up. So Mr. Fritz has some information to share, which, you know, every year in November we have a report that will, what this will show you is by school the percentage of white, black, Hispanic, Asian, and other, and that is for your instructional staff, support staff, students, and administrators. So I don't know whether administrators is on here. But in terms of compliance,
I brought copies of the desegregation order as well to reference. I know you're probably familiar with the piece on the
And we don't want to go over the whole thing.
Yeah.
You're not interested in doing that right
I've
now.
I
just want to point out some of the.
Actually, the desegregation order is 10 pages, so it's not that bad.
And it has changed over the years. You know, there's been a few changes.
So thank you, Dr. Rand, for inviting me. Mm-hmm. And so I guess in providing at least a framework for the data that is here, desegregation order talks about students and it talks about staff. And with regard to the students, at the time of the desegregation order, about 18% of the students in the district were African American. And so recognizing that we didn't want to be pulling kids from faraway places and busing them all over the place, there was an agreement that there'd be a range that was acceptable for the schools, and that's a range between 9 and 27%. So they did plus or minus 9 from the 18. And so a school is in compliance if it's above 9% and below 27%. It's not in compliance if it's below 9 or above 27.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
If you have the what did you say about the extra 9% variance?
So
if you're at 9%.
You're okay.
You're okay.
Yes. Between 9 and 27 is acceptable.
But you got that flexible thing of 9%.
The flexible thing is from 18.
Plus 9, you're
18 minus 9.
If you're at 9, if you're at zero, you're within 9%.
No.
It's 18.
18 is the target.
Okay.
9% below.
Okay.
9% above.
18
plus 9 is 27.
Didn't understand.
I apologize.
18 is the target. 18 plus 9 both ways. Okay. All right.
Because 18% of the whole population guys is African Americans. So you have 18% of each school. Well, you give a flex way, 9 this way, 9 that way. That's where it came out to 9.27.
Is that the same percentage now? Because it doesn't address blacks, it addresses minorities.
No. Specific to African American students.
Doesn't have anything to do with Hispanic, doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Even though today in our school district, the Hispanic is. Percentage exceeds the African American, but it is only with regard to African American.
And can I clarify, when you say the other side of the table, you're talking about the NAACP?
That's not the lawsuit.
Well, that the.
I think they're the.
Complainant.
De facto.
They are our liaison to having discussions
the
about the DSA.
The Sharptons.
Order,
I was looking for the name. Yeah. The Sharptons.
They're basically delegated.
Yeah.
It is NAACP.
Yes.
Yes.
That's what it says here. I don't know.
Well, that's the Mr. and Mrs. Sharpton.
So in answer to the question about the current demographic, and I'll speak to the whole chart, but actually if you go to the second page of the chart, toward the bottom you can see district totals. This is as of November 1st, 2014. You can see the black column, the students, which is the kind of tannish color in the middle there. It's 18%. It was 18% in November. You can see our Hispanic Latino students have increased over time, 23%. White students comprise 54% of the district population. Now, this is the non-charter numbers. The charter numbers are not included in these totals.
They're on the third page.
They're on the third page in a separate chart. The reason for that, a couple of them. One, we don't have access to the data about the staff there. So we put this forward separately because we do have access to the student demographics in the charter schools. So the student targets are between 9 and 27. For staff, it says that the staff composition needs to be reflective of the student population. So it doesn't specifically come out and give a number. Mm-hmm. If you assume that 9 and 27 is the kids, you can kind of make that leap. I think it could also be argued, because that language is not clear, that if you have a school that is, way more diverse than another, your staff at that school should be more diverse than a school that maybe is on the light side as far as diversity. So I think that that language is, I think, open to interpretation if we were to look at this issue further. One of the primary issues in the desegregation order is talking about instructional staff. And so you can see for each of the schools, the yellow section of the chart shows you the instructional staff at the school. That's not administrators, that's just the basically the teaching staff at the school. It includes some other credentialed staff that also work with students that are not necessarily teachers, but primarily teachers. This one's represented by IRCEA. And you can also see the support staff, so that would be secretaries or custodians or food service workers in those schools. So if you look at the chart, you can see in our schools, the ones that are either exceed or lower than the 9 to 27 would be the Alternative Center for Education. You see that one is 55.77, recognizing that is a fluid population that changes almost daily at that school, but it certainly is disproportionately black. Beachland is within compliance. Citrus is within compliance. Dodgertown exceeds compliance. Fellsmere is under in compliance. Gifford is within the numbers. Glendale is fine. Indian River Academy exceeds the 27% number. Liberty is just below the number. Although we do at our magnet schools hold seats for African American students, and we also provide transportation for students to attend, but that school we've had a struggle getting African American students to decide to attend there.
And you'll see in the North County that it's a smaller population, so even when you look at Treasure Coast and
Sebastian
Elementary, you'll see that it's a lower percentage.
Osceola Magnet is within compliance. Oslo is. Pelican Island is. Rosewood is, Sebastian, as Dr. Adams said, is on the lower side, but it's within compliance. Sebastian River Middle, and when we look at these numbers, that was a little bit surprising to me, is under, just by a sliver.
But if you look at their Hispanic,
it's
higher than most.
The minority population is
because they're fed from Felsmere, which is at 85% Hispanic.
Sebastian River High School is within compliance. Storm Grove is, Treasure Coast is, again, on the low side. Vero Beach Elementary is approaching 27%. And Vero Beach High School is within compliance. Wabasso is a sliver over, although we don't really have much control over the students assigned to Wabasso because it's based on their needs. The timing of the question is appropriate. I just yesterday had a meeting with Tony Brown, who's the head of the NAACP, to talk about these issues. He and I was in an initial meeting, and we had some conversations about this data and conversations about approaches that might be taken to create more balance. We haven't yet reached any conclusions regarding that, but it was an initial conversation to just kind of start to talk about and having a meeting of the minds on that. Yeah, it's a start. I do want to follow up that conversation in writing to make sure that what I perceived the conversation to be was what he perceived the conversation to be. Because sometimes you have a misunderstanding and you walk out of the room thinking you know what you talked about and you don't. So I want to do that.
And so one of the things that implies is if you want to balance, you have to bus. You know what I mean? So that's a hard thing for them.
We're penalizing those kids.
Right.
Let the bus before daylight in the morning. Let me say, I don't have history going this back to 1964, since I was before I was born. But I do have history going back 6 years. This has been brought up many times in the last 6 years. It's not like today is the first time we've heard this. We went through it much more formally several years ago. It gets brought up every other year. So many times, I'd love to get off money. Most people would. So I just don't want there to be a misconception that this is brand new and nobody's ever touched it. And again, we've had conversations with people in that, you know, where Dr. Teske, whoever, have always had these conversations. I can tell you, hopefully we get some kind of dialogue going. Ms. DiResta talked earlier about the districts can walk in lockstep or they can walk in adversarial. In the past, doesn't mean necessarily a foretelling the future, in the past, whenever this has even been mentioned, in a setting like this, or heaven forbid on the during school board meeting, the reaction has been very swift and very adversarial. Mm-hmm. Extremely adversarial. In the past.
So leadership up there now.
So I think there would be, you know, there would be significant homework to be done, or you know, significant work to be done on that end. I'm just speaking for the last 6 years. That's been, like I said, anytime it's been mentioned, the flags have been gone. You know, it just, Mr.
If I may, I think the fact that it was mentioned at the last board meeting by the NAACP president at the meeting probably tips their hand that they think it's still needed. I can't speak for Mr. Brown, but I suspect that we are not at that point yet. Do we aspire to that? I hope so. But the fact that he raised it to me said that we're probably not at that point. But.
No, but I just think, you know, we have to be realistic. We live in a community that is segregated. And if we have community schools, look at Felsmere, they are going to be segregated. And I think one of the things that concerns me is this busing. I remember when we had this conversation at some point, we had data that showed where our students were going. Mm-hmm. And the children from Dodgertown, which is the Gifford school, are bused all over the place, and I'm sure that's still
true.
The case. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that just can't be good for that community to have their children being bused out.
But that's what you have to do to comply with the DSEG order. And, you know, and I do think we need to bring it up, and it needs to be brought up every year, but we need to really have serious conversations about how we can get closer to coming up from under it. Because right now the data, even this very preliminary data, there's no way we can say we're ready. Lift that thing, because our schools are just not in compliance. Mm-hmm. It's complicated.
So I guess looking back at the attorney, because I agree, you have to take action. But maybe the action we make today is for a future date.
After the superintendent's
and next year's role and whatever. But no, but I'm saying the thought process. It's so fluid, as you said, with the busing and everything. You could never come out. I mean, that was kind of the conversation I had. It's with the busing and everybody moving and the people entrenched in, I don't want to go to Liberty, this is my community, I want to go to my community school. So how would you, if things are status quo and yet we keep trying, what would be some of, and I want to say court evidence, let's say we set a date for 2018, which is for, you know, or 2019, 4 years from now, 4 years track history, that we met with the NAACP, we went over extra bus routes, we went over this, we advertised for minorities and blah, blah, blah. What is the things that we need to, because we could say we didn't do it for 50 years, and we could keep going, and then 4 years from now, some other board member will be new and say, why aren't we doing this? Where can we start from today in dialogue, tracking, gathering that information, so 4 years from now we have, this is the best we can do. I mean, that's where I think that you're right. Where do we go from here? We're not ready now, but where do we start? You know, we're Mr. Fritz. Where do you start with the file going 2015?
I want to add another element, because I only talked about half of this. The other half is the staffing side of it. Okay.
Which is the harder one.
And I think if I've been able to take the pulse, I think that's the bigger issue.
More than half. Yes. Okay. And if you read the language in the order, reflective of the student population, we're not. Okay. You go beyond that. I think we only have like maybe three schools on this list. If you look at the staff population, the somewhat mirror the student population. So we have that issue. There also is language in the DSEG order that speaks to 20-40% of our annual hires being black.
What?
That's written in here.
And if you don't,
then it says you need to show the offers that you make to candidates that have not been accepted. Right. Well, we don't have those. I mean, we don't have offers. We can't find the black candidates.
That's right. To
come here. That our challenge is a recruiting challenge. It's not a hiring challenge. I mean, we're compliant with the EEOC, and we're compliant with discrimination laws and all of that. That is not an issue.
I believe we're even compliant with the staff that we do hire, that we're getting a 10%. We're nowhere close to.
Yeah, the percentage of individuals who we hire reflects the percent who apply.
Right.
So there's no disparity there. So it is a recruiting piece, and we talked at the was the last board meeting where we talked about recruitment efforts. We are continuing to step forward with regards to diverse recruitment. We're going to 2 additional historically black colleges this year that we didn't go to last year. We're going to some more urban areas, things like that, and more diverse campuses, including University of Florida. And we're making efforts to, although they were talking about, when we were talking with the Career Center there, they're having trouble with diverse recruitment at University of Florida. So
you look across the United States, and we fall into that. I mean, it is. I mean, there are lots of other positions that young African American professionals are looking at.
And that's what we heard, last year. I did the visit to Florida Memorial, which is in Miami. It's a traditionally black college. And I had young men and women coming up to me who could name their job. Mm-hmm. And teaching was not their... They came to be nice and see us and all that, but they're like, well, I'm thinking about being an attorney and I'm thinking about doing this. teaching might be a nice backup. Well, we don't want to hire people who teach as a backup. We want to hire people who want to teach.
And they have the opportunity to go to Atlanta and to other places that, you know, offer more.
It doesn't mean we don't keep trying.
I will tell you this, because when you go recruiting, I don't know, Mr. Schonk, if you guys run into it, you know, when I worked for a big firm here, I was one of the younger guys, so they'd send me off to college campuses. Mm-hmm. You know, and in my firm right now, my partner and I, we're looking for a young staff accountant, something like that. It's hard as hell to get somebody to come off a college campus, unless they're from here.
Right.
It's hard as can be to get somebody to come from Gainesville, Florida, and hanging out on University Avenue every night to come to Vero Beach. You know,
and by the way, we have a new segment.
Unless they're from here.
So you're going to love it here.
Unless they're from here, you know, white, black, brown, blue, purple. Unless they're from here, or they're marrying or have a boyfriend or a girlfriend that's from here and got a job. You have to find somebody who has a connection here. Well, it's very hard to recruit here for young, right out of college.
They're also, if they're not fresh out of college, there has to be a job for their spouse. If they're married, and there aren't a lot of jobs around here, especially ones that, you know, pay a living wage. So that's another challenge we have.
So maybe we could show the student and support, but when we get down to the staff, that's where we lack. So again, and now we've mentioned it's an issue, and there's no problem solving for that. How would we be able to is it like a lost battle, or how would we be able to document that and show that?
You bring in economists. Bring in expert on demographics. You bring in
labor experts.
Hiring experts. Yeah. You bring in HR people. That's how you'd have to make your argument that way. Emma, how is that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would just go on to say that you document all the efforts to recruit in all of these diverse areas. You document every time you've said, we would love for you to come to Vero Beach, and they say, you know, I'm going to go to Atlanta or, you know, whatever. I think that goes to the language in the DSEG order that says that you're supposed to hire between 20% to 40% every year of African-American new hires. But if you don't meet that, you just need to document the number of letters of intent or any other way that you've said, we've asked, we invited people to come, and they're just not interested in us. You document it, and I think, you know, impossibility of performance is a defense. You know, it's going to be harder to meet or harder to get some sympathy from a judge, but, I mean, that's what you put forward.
Is there any cost into trying to implement this DSEG? Are we incurring costs? I'm looking from a cost-saving factor. Is there any cost that we are, you know, how are the costs? Because we might want to, as I said, save, make that a priority, pick a date, future date, drop-dead date to file this, get the expert witnesses, because if we're spending $50,000, $100,000 a year now to implement this, that's $500,000 in 5 years right now. So how, what do we think about that? How are we going to do this, Mr. Searcy? What do you think?
Well, I think we need to read the contract there, because this, what I see, what we just said and what the attorney just said, significant effort will be made to bring the ratio of minority teachers. It doesn't say black. African American. It says minority. So you add the two together, or maybe I don't know what you add together.
No, it's African American.
Right.
I'm reading what it says here.
We've been told year after year that because if that were the case, then you can add up your Hispanic and your black and your Asian, and everybody would be pretty much where they need to be. So I think we've been told that unless that's erroneous.
I'm just looking at
Mr. Gresson.
It is. It's ironically racist.
Mr. Gresson.
It is.
When you go back to the original court-approved consent order, 1964, what we're looking at is something from the 90s where we've updated some information. When you go back to the 1964 document and it's talking about minority race, okay, the definition is white or Negro. So while I agree today minority means so much more, in 1964 what the piece of paper was talking about. In 1964, that was then set aside, and we amended it with all of these, you know, future.
Well,
you know, as we were asking questions, you know, another question to ask, more important than I think it's cost effective, we want to get out of this, is how is this impacting our children?
Right.
How is this impacting our students? Is it in their best interest overall that our school district be under a DSEG order or not? What is best for our children? Because, yeah, we can save money and blah, 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 but in the end, what does that mean for our students and our schools? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that if you look at what happens with busing and taking children out of their neighborhoods and all the, you know, that is probably not a good thing for children.
Mm-hmm.
But and it also creates, you know, when you look at your schools, our schools are diversifying, and schools that before were very homogeneous are now dealing with a tremendous amount of diversity, not just Black kids, mm-hmm. Latino kids, kids from poverty, kids with mental health issues, kids with disabilities, and a lot of them need the professional development to know how to work with children from poverty, to know how to work with children from other cultures. So beyond that, what, you know, maybe a conversation could be from staff perspective, you know, from folks that work with our children, what is in the best interest of our children? Is this in any way beneficial? The fact that there's a DSEG order, does it benefit children in any way or not?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it could be argued the other way. It's about choice today. Mm-hmm. It is about choice. And it's not about, we don't have neighborhood schools today. We have schools located in neighborhoods, but we really don't have neighborhood schools, because if you look at the in-zone, out-of-zone waivers and where people are choosing to go, they're going all over the place. So really the word is choice. I mean, that's what we're talking about when we talk about charters and magnets and so on and so forth. So I don't think I can understand where you're coming from, but I really think you, as you look at your alternatives, you've got to be putting choice into this mix to say, how would we do that? How could we provide choice? You know what I'm saying?
That leads to, I mean, I had a conversation with the person in my role in St. Lucie County about this, because they have reach unity status, and I asked them, how'd you do that? Because St. Lucie County kind of looks like our county, I think. You know, I live close to the line, and I right there looks
it
maybe even
to,
yeah, there may be more disparity in that community between wealthy and non. And he said exactly that. They did it through choice at a cost. Mm-hmm. Any student anywhere in that school district can choose to go to any school, and they bus them. Okay, mm-hmm. It quadrupled the cost of transportation mm-hmm. for the district, but they wanted to get to unity status, and so they basically came up with a system by which any school was available to any child in the district. That's a way they approached it, and this is just from one person who I know in the school district who said that's how they got there.
St. Lucie also had a unique situation where they had a very large African-American population in the northern part of the county. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it also is, where are you busing from, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they had very high transportation costs just trying to get students, you know, under the DSEG order. Our population centers are a little different, you know, I do appreciate that you remember that they're all choice
all
today.
All choice schools, sir.
And then another question that we haven't discussed, if we're really thinking about unitary status, is the fact that we have a charter school that is pretty much all Black, mm-hmm. and it's not a lot of students, because our charter schools are relatively small, but that attracts children mm-hmm. that could be going mm-hmm. to other schools, and that, I mean, that's just part of that mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That puzzle. But, you know, Dr. Adams, that's why I asked the question, but I think, because I think it's by having these conversations mm-hmm. that these things come mm-hmm. out, and when we don't have them, we just keep thinking, well, we can't do it, and then as you start exploring, mm-hmm. you think, well, maybe there are ways, but it's going to cost money, or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I just think we need to have this conversation, and it needs to be ongoing.
afterwards.
And I really want to give Mr. Fritz credit because he's established a good relationship with the NAACP, and I feel like Mr. Brown respects him, and so they're able to sit and have dialogue on issues, you know, and that's important, you know. So
takes some donuts when you go. That always works for me.
Food.
Everyone in food. If you want to have a meeting, have food.
You got gifts yet, Charlie. Where are they?
Even the superintendent's coffee knows that.
I want to get back to Mr. Gresten. You indicated there were, just a short while back, there were 16 districts that were still under DSAG orders. It's down to eight.
Yeah, it's eight or nine. No, you're correct. Eight or nine now at this point.
If we could have our staff contact those schools that have been relieved from the DSAG orders and find out what the commonality, what the thing is that made it work for them, it might help us. The big thing is going to be the PR with Tony Brown. I think that's critical. But if we knew what worked for the other school districts, I think that would be beneficial to us.
Carol's not here anymore. Go ahead.
I think Ms. Meadows had a very good point, though, that the other side, you know, we can have this conversation, but the other party, I would like Mr. Fritz to let him know that we had this open dialogue and then ask him that the board has a question, and I think it would be your question. How does he feel? I mean, point blank to that question, how do you feel they would like you to explain how busing children outside of their community is of benefit to them? Do they feel displaced? How is that beneficial to the student? I would like to hear that side of their story.
May I real quick interject? Several years ago, we had talked myself into another afternoon here. It goes back a few years. We had a big, a rather large meeting here. And the idea was to have it ongoing and not like
with the NAACP.
Yeah.
Okay.
And not just, you know, and there was, you know, okay, but members of the Gifford community, members of the, you know, tell us what, you know, talk to us. Tell us why you feel this, what the job. Now, you know, you get anywhere. I don't care if it's NAACP or if it's a teacher's union or whatever, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of use in the session. But once that's over with, it turned into a profitable afternoon or a morning or whatever we did. You know, the one thing that reminds me of that is if you're saying, Mr. Fritz, go back and ask on our behalf.
And invite you.
I'm
talking myself into another meeting.
No, I
think it's a good one. I think those are
good
ones.
Yeah, well, it's been several years since we did that, and I don't know. That's, I know Johnny Thorne is here, the old basketball coach from River Beach. Fritz?
I didn't ask that specific question in our meeting yesterday. However, you know, we were talking about Dodger Town because that's one of the schools that's overrepresented here, and he said, I think that if you told a certain neighborhood that they needed to leave Dodger Town, they wouldn't want to leave because they think highly of the principal we have there and the work that's going on in the school and the direction the school is going. He said, I think that would be a challenge. So we're talking about how to, you know, work through that. I think if all of our schools are high quality, which goes back to what Mr. Gresta was saying as an approach, this may stop being an issue on the student side. But I also do think that the staff side, as Mr. McCain said, is maybe the larger issue for them, and I don't think there's satisfaction with regards to staff. And I think it comes from a couple of things in listening with Tony and other members of the NAACP. I don't think it has really to do with the color of the people teaching the kids, although we certainly want to be reflective. I think it has more to do with the cultural competency of our staff. So if you have a white teacher with a black student or Latino student, can they connect with that student? Can they reach that student? Is there a sort of subtle racism underlying the way they approach things, either real or perceived? I mean, it could be either way. I think some of the challenge, it goes way deeper than the color of the teacher's skin. It has to do with their way of interacting with the kids. And I think you know,
one of the superintendent's goals is to have training on cultural diversity.
Right,
that he's
right. And we're planning that.
But that's part of it. That's why. Yeah. The Ruby Payne, if you ever heard of Ruby Payne and
so,
what she's done, that's part of
but
it.
But it has to be meaningful.
Yeah.
Because we did the Ruby Payne, and Ruby Payne came to Indian River.
Wow.
And when I've gone into schools and I asked about it, it's like, yeah, we did that. You check it off.
It's going to reach the heart.
It has to be ongoing. Yeah. If you're going to do cultural competency, it can't be like the talk mm-hmm. on cultural and mm-hmm. the talk on mm-hmm. poverty. Mm-hmm. It has to be ongoing because these teachers deal with so much. And every year when they start working with their kids, they should be looking at their class from the lens of respecting diversity, from the lens of poverty, and identifying the kids and being able to work with them. Because a training they did, a professional learning community they did 5 years ago on Ruby Payne's book is useless today if it's reinforcement. I mean, that's what every teacher knows. When you teach your kids any subject, you repeat and repeat and repeat in many different ways. And that, to me, is the biggest challenge. You can do a training, but if there is no continual follow-up, it's for naught, and the children will still feel that way.
And the big challenge, I mean, you're absolutely right, and I don't care what it is, but the big challenge is the mobility of everybody. You look at your schools and your leaders and from one five-year period to the next, and, you know, that's why once it's embedded into the culture of the school that this is who we are and what we're going to do, it can sustain itself. But, you know, right, you've got a lot of mobility, so it has to be very deliberate in order to sustain that.
Before we conclude, I do want to point out, and I think this is a celebration, if you look at our administrative team, mm-hmm. we are not where we need to be on Hispanic administrators, but you know, if you look at black administrators, we're exceeding 18%, 23.2%. Even when you look at school-based administrators, it's actually 25.5%. So I think that we have done some good work there. Both with encouraging promising teachers of color to pursue administration, but I think that's something we should celebrate.
The progress that we've made is phenomenal.
Right.
But we just
You're
can't.
Right.
We just can't,
get ahead of
under
the curve.
This. Yeah. Well, not this. This is seven.
Yeah.
it's
right.
Anyway, all right, Mr. Fritz, we'll provide that along.
Thank you.
You know, it's kind of funny, though, if you think about it from a macro point of view. You know, I was born in 67. It's impossible for me. This is only 3 years before I was born. It seems like this was like hundreds of years before I was born. And, you know, I'm 47, so anybody over, 50? You know, I went to my first day my first day in Rosewood, Miss Atkins, Mildred Atkins was my teacher, you know. First and third grade teachers, you know, you had. White teachers, black friends, but people who are a few years older than me.
So
it's one generation ahead of me lived in a different world.
Even if you look at Tony was probably part of that.
It's kind of what I'm
he
getting at.
He was probably part
that's
of
what
that
that's
1964.
You know what, Matt?
Or 69.
You have to be realistic because
you lived it.
You lived that transition.
Yeah.
But if you're a person of color, it's a very different experience.
No, I'm saying this.
When I went to public school, I had to deal with racism. I had to deal with discrimination. And this was much later.
Yeah.
And I still have to deal with it today. So I think, you know, it's easy for us to look at it from the outside in. But when someone lives it, that is a totally different experience. And you can't deny their reality. I've had people that have come up to me and talked about those immigrants, that. And then they look at me, but we're not talking about you. And I'm like, really? You know, so I think that it's a very delicate dance we do because we see everything through our lens. But, you know,
everybody
each has our own experience. So,
All right, what do you need to move on? Ms. Manage, you got anything?
I do. I want to continue my follow-up from this morning, and I wanted to just open up that conversation again about the utilization of the alternative center We used to have, I don't know if the board members are familiar, we used to have a program years ago that was cut due to budget restraints. It was called the HOPE program. Mm-hmm. And it was a program that originally, I don't remember what school it was at. I don't know if it was at ACE, but then it moved to the Gifford Youth Achievement Center. And then due to budget restraints, it was
and
cut.
That was
but I think that there's room in the ACE if we figure out how to use it to focus on students, because right now half of the facility is being used for adult ed and Indian River State College has a part of it, and I understand that. Mm-hmm. That's commendable, but we're K-12, we're pre-K-12, and our priority should be our students, and some of these students that are struggling, you know, when I every year that I visited the ACE, a lot of those students don't want to leave. That small environment and that connection with their teachers really changes their lives. And I think that we have potential. Like when I visit, I see three or four kids in a classroom. You know, they get that one-on-one. We could be using that space better to serve those kids that we know are failing in our larger schools. And especially when it comes to suspension, instead of putting them on the street where for sure they're going to fail, if we can have a way of having that suspension and the whole program at the ACE. You know, it's something to consider. You know, we've got a lot on our plate, but if we really want to support the kids, that is going to make a difference.
Well, that's, you know, that, and that might, sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
So that's a budget issue. It's something you need to know more about, okay, because it is something that, you know, we had and it worked. You know, it was a budget issue. It was actually started by a community member. It was started by a pastor in the community. Then it moved under the school district. But I do want to go back to the DSEG order, and this was part of it. When we closed Gifford 6 as a sixth grade school, the community was involved in that. And they asked that part, as we shifted and we reorganized, that the community be part of that, and we have community adult education and some things that they could attend in that community. So that is actually why part of those facilities are used for medical programs, and the college has the air conditioning program that's in part of that school. But that was through interaction with the community, and that is part of our DSEG order, is that we work with the community. And whenever we open a facility, we need to meet with them. But I did want to point that out, that it was through negotiations with the community.
Can you just explain, because I know HOPE as a high school course.
Oh, yes.
So
let's do this. This is what I was going to suggest. Can you, just on that, next round,
sure.
10 minutes.
Yes.
Go over some of those programs that have fallen by the wayside. There's more than...
Yeah, Piper, Simon Mall.
These are all, we're going through all that stuff. They were more expensive per child than.
And there were other reasons for that.
But that's basically, you know, but it came down to it.
It did.
And it sucked. But I think it's more of a budgetary issue. This is something that maybe before budget time comes around, as we start exploring that, we need to get
information. Yeah.
And I can give you even what the cost was.
I know, as a teacher.
Ms. Frost, do you have anything?
No, no, sir.
Ms. Searcy, you got any other hornet's nest you want to go on?
are you saying that there is hope in our
country? There always has been, and there always will.
$100 million out of budget. All hope was lost. Searcy, you have anything else?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. All right, we've gone around.
Oscar Mike.
Any committee reports?
They didn't meet.
Okay, that's easy.
There will be a new development next week's might be PNC. So I can't really get the update thing going, but it's Sebastian. It'll be in Sebastian Elementary School plan unit. It's a development that may affect the school. When I get the plans, I'll be going, you know, it's in between meetings, but I will just assure the board that I'll be meeting with Mr. Sanders, or at least discussing it with him if there's any traffic or safety issues.
And I have one thing too.
All right, Ms. Miller. Ms. Searcy, do you have anything?
No.
All
I don't have anything.
All right. On the board agenda tonight, and I just want to be very transparent about this, on the job descriptions for the pre-K coordinator, that is asking for an administrative position. Right now, that position does all of the pre-K, ESE, basically the VPK that we have and the VPK pre-K programs we have. And she is retiring. Kim McCorson, who's wonderful, is retiring. But she has not been in a position where she can evaluate those teachers. And so I think it's a position that is going to be growing. The importance of it is growing in our community, that early education piece. So we've had to pay her all summer because the VPK goes all summer, so we've had to pay her extra earnings. So it's really not too much more than we've had to pay over the years. But I do want you to know, and it's out there, but I want to be sure that you understand that you are approving an administrative position for the coordinator of pre-K on tonight's agenda. I'm trying to remember. It's a coordinator, which is our lowest level administrative position. You start at step zero, and it's on there, but I can't remember.
The $6,000 difference between her extended contract.
I know, but what is it, about $71,000? Gosh.
Oh, the
what is the cost of that position?
I don't know off the top of my head. We looked at the delta between the position plus the extended contract.
Yeah, which she's getting paid right now.
Changing to a coordinator position.
Yeah.
So that was about $6,000.
Does that delta include benefits? The full package?
Yeah, benefits are the same cost.
Regardless of but it's just, I want to be very transparent about that. So if you didn't notice it, I want you to know that it's there.
That's the only thing that I didn't see in there was the cost or the salary or whatever.
Yeah, it depends on the experience that the person comes in with, you know, as to where they fall. But it is, you can go, if you come in with no administrative experience, you start in step zero. If you come in with 10 years experience in that particular kind of area, then you're at a different salary. So it could be a range.
It could be that we come out net positive.
Yeah, with what we're paying now. But the point is Mr. Mastercy, we'll look that up. We'll give you the range. I'll have that range for you tonight.
But the person that's coming in has experience, and they're not going to start at zero. They're going to start.
No, the person that's there right now is retiring. We want to change this position as we advertise for
now.
No.
Okay.
No. She retires in May, and then we'd like to be able to advertise.
Anything else?
We didn't have that at this discussion session. We said we were going to follow up on the charter schools and their drug testing policy. That needs to be followed up.
Yeah, I have information if you want to.
Yes, I did want to follow up on that because I did when you sent the letter to all of us, I asked you then, should we look at it? And your answer was, well,
certainly. I mean, you can, but I would suggest, not the board in isolation, but with the superintendent as far as charter school monitoring plan.
So, it was brought up that, just to refresh your memory, as we were talking about our own random drug testing policy for students who participate in extracurricular competitive activities, which is on the agenda tonight to be, it came up that the Charter High was random drug testing all students. Okay, so what I heard is, can you get information about that? So we did get information from the charter school. I know Mr. Gusta sent you a memo kind of summarizing what we found out. But just to go over my own notes of that, the Charter High requires all students to pass a drug test as a precondition to enrollment. So you must be drug tested before you can be enrolled. And a student who fails a drug test the second time is dismissed from the school. All students have to be agreed to random drug testing at any time during the year. Okay, so those are preconditions, and the second time. Went back to statute, and really I'm kind of quoting the information that Ms. DeGrasse sent you, but it does say that
a charter school is required to enroll all eligible students who submit timely applications, limited only by the number of available seats at the charter school. And there are conditions, I mean, there are, it does allow to specifically target. And I think I could use a charter high as an example. They're kind of performing arts, okay? So you can target those types of students. Some charter schools are ESC. They might even focus on autistic. You can target those kinds of
classifications.
Yeah, that classification of student. That allows you to do that, you know, as part of the statute. But it does further say that you enroll all eligible students unless you have this specific group that, you know, that you wish to target in your charter. We used 20 years ago when I was at Sebastopol High School, wanted to do the same thing. But we were told we could do the athletes, and there was a recent ruling in the Vernonia case that we could randomly drug test the student athletes. So I was familiar with that. Since that time, you found out, and I found out, that the Supreme Court passed another ruling that says that you can expand that to all competitive extracurricular activities. But in both of these, it was careful not to say that you can randomly drug test all students. It was specific to those students participating in those competitive activities. So I don't see that that the law or your statute provides that kind of a an allowance for any school, public school, to do that. You know, public schools are about access. They're about equity. So that's the information that I have to share with you in terms of what's in their handbook and what's in their student policies. And they've submitted a copy of that too for us to review.
So would we be within our rights to have our attorney draft a letter that we all, you know, have a copy of the student handbook, and we understand that they're doing that, and that that is an exclusion from the statute that tells us that we must include all students, something to that effect? Is that something you can do in a better way than I just said?
Absolutely. In fact, the superintendent and I actually worked together on a letter for the charter school. The open question, or what I think it would be important to hear your discussion is, you know, I can lay it out, and we've laid out what the law says and what the statutes say. I think the ultimate question is, how do we conclude the letter? Do I say, you know, we want to hear your plan for coming into compliance with the U.S. Supreme Court cases? Do we want to, you know, because I'm a lawyer, cease and desist or else?
What is your direction?
I'm an ADR guy. let's do the right thing.
You know. Yeah. And, you know, it's been said to me, and Mr. Frost has said it to me twice, you didn't know.
I can't believe it.
He says, I can't believe that you didn't know that. I didn't know it. My staff didn't know it. I do not pay attention to. And here's the other thing, is we went back and looked at the applications and we looked at the contracts. And there wasn't anything in it that I would have read that would have said to me that, and I honestly still today don't know how long they've done it. You know what I mean? So it's not out to catch anybody doing something wrong.
You know, I think this board's challenge is when you can say you don't know, you can make the case for that, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But now that we know,
right,
we can't make believe we don't know. And our challenge is that our charter schools do not like to be told or asked or anything because of that antagonism. So what we need to do, I think that instead of any kind of cease or desist language that's going to completely alienate them, I think what is your plan for coming into compliance is the way to go. However, the board has to be ready for a consequence, because knowing the attitudes of some of the folks, they may just say, you know what, that's none of your business, you stay out of my business. Mm-hmm. And then what do we do? Say, oh, okay, you can continue not being in compliance and walk away. So I think that it really opens up a can of worms that this board has not wanted to open up in years. Because you could send a letter, you can ask for a plan, and what if they decide?
That's my question. Are you going to pull their charter?
Can we?
There is a provision under state law that allows it's a reason to terminate a charter contract for failing to comply with federal law.
And I want to. I'm strongly. I hope it doesn't come to that. That's, you know, listen. When you are an administrator and your employee does something wrong, it hurts me to write them up. But I always have to say, Mr. Smith didn't. I didn't do this to Mr. Smith. Mr. Yeah. Smith did this to Mr. Smith. So my point is that we don't want to be like that.
No.
We just found out some information, and we want to pass them on that they're not in compliance, and how are they going to come into compliance? And we will deal with that when we get to that. But the bottom line is that they are a charter under our school district. They had no problem coming here with their handout, and I have no problem trying to give them money or trying to work with them. But I do feel that they owe, as a school district, the relationship is two ways. Mm-hmm. And I think Ms. Jimenez is exactly right. And I don't even want to look about that, because I think they may say, we didn't know. We don't keep an attorney really on hand. We do per diem, and we don't really have a lot of that going on. We didn't know. We don't know what the answer is, but so we should take the first step.
Yeah, I think we should be gentle.
Another thing, I agree.
Be gentle.
And they're not successful because of drug testing. That they are very successful, and it's I have to believe it's not because of random drug testing that they're successful, or the kids have to take a test. They do a lot of things right, you know what I mean? And I don't think this is would hurt them in terms of the kid, quality of the kids.
It's more an ego thing. It's going to be more of,
I think they do a great job.
Yeah, unfortunately. Being candid here and all.
Right. And that's the thing, being candid. I'm amazed that, I've said it numerous times, I'm amazed the district ignores, because as a teacher, it's Bachelor Member High School, and I work for Sean, or with Sean, Mr. O'Keefe, who's the principal of Vero High, and we knew that kids came back to us for that reason. I mean, they popped positive once, they tried their 30-day intervention, it didn't work for them, and guess what, they're back in my classroom. Same year. Gobsmacked that this is a shock to anyone.
Mr. Frost, and that's another caveat, because they are not allowed to expel students by statute. And that's another thing that we don't comply with. They can't expel kids, so they figured a way of working around it so they don't use the word expel. But technically, you know, and nobody likes to talk about that, but when a charter school doesn't work for a kid for whatever reason, and a lot of times it's because they misbehave, we have to take them back.
Right.
We can't say, no, you were doing drugs. No, we have to take them back. And they send them back, but that's never considered an expulsion, because they, by statute, cannot expel students. Those students have to come before the board. So, you know, I think that that's the slippery slope we face, because if we're going to be asking people to comply, we have to be consistent. We can't choose when we want compliance, because that gives the perception that we only comply when it's in our interest for some reason. And so I bring that up because, you know, it's a very...
Yeah, what I would like to do, if you would agree, is I would like to send a letter, but I would ask that they... you know, look at this and give us, you know, here's how we've interpreted this, that they are in violation of the federal law. So, you know, we'd like that to work with them to resolve this issue. And, you know, it's not we're not trying to threaten them. Yeah. I know I'm going to get a response to this, you know, but I feel like we're not trying to catch them doing bad, but when you find out information and it's not what the law says, if they can prove otherwise, that's fine.
Right.
You know, well, because that's
what I was getting at is beyond that initial shock is the secondary shock that no parent has had their child removed from that school for that purpose and said, I'm hiring her. You know, and we're gonna get my student back in that excellent school. along those lines. So,
but when you're told as a parent that you have to do this to
right,
get
and
in,
we sign the student
that
code of conduct.
For what it's worth,
you
know?
That for face value.
Yeah.
I like to think that they don't know, like they didn't realize, that, because I, when
yeah.
I had heard about it, it
I
never dawned on me.
Yeah.
You know, because I had asked years ago, why don't we just randomly taste all, you know,
yeah.
do this to all our students in our public schools? This is a great idea. And I was told, no, you can't do that. And I never connected that.
Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying. I never said, but wait a minute.
And maybe they don't either. I don't.
But
I
hope
honestly
that they don't
know.
Know
that.
All right, let's go
and
ahead
that they'll work
let's wrap this up.
So
I
want
to make one quick request. In addition to sending the letter, would it be possible to, you know, different communication channels, maybe call Mr. Waddell and Ms. Versa and make
yeah.
that.
Absolutely.
Call a meeting too,
sure.
and to discuss how we can move together
sure.
proactively
I have,
rather than,
I have no
than sending a cease
that.
And desist letter and we're coming to get you
from
and we've got a padlock and a bat.
Yeah, I think we're
okay.
Great.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else, anybody? All right. We'll stand adjourned.
You're like cease and desist.
No.
Okay.
As a consumer of
that.
Those recent products.
Okay.
I'm a roll. I'm a roll. I'm a roll.